Hey, we'll call the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims to order. And first order of business will be to look at the minutes that we had from the July 16th meeting. Maybe just a moment to look at that and see if anyone has a motion.
I would move approval.
Okay, Senator Olsen moves approval of the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. And I have signed, and if you would also, and then you can pass it on to the Cheryl for a signature, and I think we'll be finished with that piece of business. We have claims against the state. First comes up is Department of Revenue. And would counsel give us some background on this?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The first claim to be heard is a Department of Revenue claim by Mr. Yuri Farber, who I believe is here. And essentially the claim is that Mr. Farber mailed applications for property tax refunds on April 12th, 2006 for both the 2004 and 2005 years. The total amount of the two years claimed is $2,390. And as I understand it, Mr. Farber claims the applications were lost in the mail and that he did not follow up because of marriage fraud and resulting depression and other problems from that problem. And the department denied the claims, and then there was at least one appeal to the department in an administrative procedure that was also denied. I believe I have that correct, and the departmental representative can correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay. Okay, do we have someone from the department that wants to give us a little background on this? Please identify yourself for the record. Do we have a microphone at that table?
We do not. I didn't see about getting one.
Here's one right there, I think.
I'm not sure where it's plugged in, though.
Sorry about the delay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Joint Subcommittee. Excuse me. My name is Rick Walzer. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll try and make it short. The claim was denied because we had no record of timely receiving Mr. Farber's property tax refund claims for these 2 years. And at the by the time he resubmitted his claim, the statute of limitations for filing the claim had expired. There's a one-year time limit for filing a property tax refund claim. And I would point out to the members of the subcommittee that while there is a provision that extends the time for filing a regular individual income tax refund claim if the taxpayer has a what's called a financial disability, there is no such provision that extends the time for filing a property tax refund claim. It's a flat 1 year without any extensions being available. And I think legislatively the reason for that is that property tax refunds are in the nature of a benefit program. So That's why the time limit is a hard and fast 1 year. So for those reasons, I would ask the joint subcommittee to deny this claim. Thank you very much.
Okay. And if maybe, unless there's some clarifying questions right at this point, we'll see if Mr. Farber is here.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Farber, if you'd like to come up and present your claim. We prefer, I'd like to get a little background on it first, so that's the reason why the departments came up first. But if you could kind of clarify as to the situation and what your why you filed the claim.
Yes, sir. On April 12, 2006, I filed claims for a property tax refund for both 2004 and 2005 years. And then I was unable to follow up on the claim because I was a victim of a marriage fraud, which I discovered in October 2006. And that was so devastating that I had a severe depression after that. And I was totally unable to keep track of my finances or anything like that. At the time when I actually filled out property tax refund, I brought a witness. My mother actually witnessed me when I filled out forms on April 12th. And I brought her as a witness to testify that indeed I did send property tax refund forms. If they got lost in the mail, I don't know, but in June 2008, I filed again, and I got a denial, and then I filed an appeal with Department of Revenue, and I got explanation from Department of Revenue that I missed the deadline, but I did send applications indeed, and that was a basis for my appeal. I just couldn't follow up on it because of devastation in my life. I basically lost 4 years out of my life. I got duped into a fraudulent marriage by a foreign national. She married me to get a green card, and I had absolutely no idea that I was played, you know. And then I filed for a divorce in October 2006. So I was basically living a life for 2 years and 6 months, and then after that I didn't recover from emotional trauma for 2 other years after that. And you know, and I understand that it does have a deadline for a property tax refund, but in my opinion I did everything what I was supposed to do, and I just couldn't follow up on it because of circumstances of my marriage fraud that will happen to me.
Okay, the questions.
Mr. Chair, it strikes me in your testimony here, you write about that when your ex left the home, she took all your paperwork and your tax forms. Is that correct?
Yes, she stole everything from me. She stole my paperwork. She stole my tax forms. She even stole my passport, my United States citizen passport. So I actually had to call her, and I told her if she doesn't return my passport, I'm going to have to call the police.
Did she return any of those?
She returned a passport, but that's it. She didn't return anything else.
Other questions? Sir Lance.
Mr. Farber, thank you for appearing before us this afternoon. Let me first say that I'm sorry for what you went through. I have personal knowledge of another individual that went through precisely the same thing. And there's no doubt in my mind that he was a victim of exactly the same kind of situation, marriage fraud. as you put it, that you are facing for precisely the same reasons. So it is not at all unheard of. It's, in fact, more common than I think many people are even know about. Followed up with the allegations of abuse, which qualifies under certain federal statutes to allow a person who would not otherwise be allowed to stay in this country to remain in this country during those proceedings. So I'm not passing any judgment in your particular situation, but I certainly understand or see familiarity in what you are claiming here. What I don't understand, maybe you can help me understand a little bit better, is the nature of what the department actually referred to as a financial disability. I'm going to ask them to clarify a little bit exactly what that means in another statute. But do you have any medical documentation of being diagnosed with major depression or anything like that would substantiate a claim that you're basically unable to take care of your own affairs?
Sir, I didn't particularly. I didn't go to see a doctor, but my mother is here, and she can actually tell me. My mother actually almost died when she found out that marriage fraud was committed because she loved my so-called ex-spouse like her own daughter, and she took care of her. She had seizures, okay? She had epilepsy. And I spent 2 years of my life just driving from one hospital to another hospital because she would end up having a seizure. Sometimes she wouldn't take medications, you know, for seizures, and she would have a seizure. And I spent like 2 years of my life just because I thought that I can make a difference in a person's life. And I was married to her, and I didn't know that I was played around. And my mother almost died because when I came home at one point, I saw a totally different individual, you know, sitting in my living room. And exactly what she said, how much money are you willing to give me right now? Or I'm going to hit my head against the wall, and I'm going to call 911, I'm going to call cops, and I'm going to allege spousal abuse. You will get arrested, you will lose your job, and if you don't do it right now, I will do it. And she had a 911 already dialed. So somehow I managed to pull myself together. She physically assaulted my mother as well. You know, she grabbed her hand, and she injured my mother's hand. Obviously, you may have a question why I didn't call the police myself when she physically assaulted my mother. I figured out that I am dealing with a professional criminal, and somehow I managed to pull myself together at that point. And I knew that if I would have called the police, she would turn everything around, and I wouldn't even know what to do. Most likely, I would get arrested because I was scared, you know. My face was white. My blood pressure went to 180. My mother's blood pressure went to like 190. And then after that, you know, trauma was so bad that my mom can actually testify that I couldn't even speak for a couple of months after that. You know, it's so painful. It's like when you're playing, I mean, it's difficult to explain what it is exactly if a person did not experience anything like that himself. But the trauma was so devastating that I just, you know, it felt like I was going crazy, you know. But I didn't look any psychiatric treatment or anything like that because I truly believe that if you can't, you know, if you can't manage, if you can't pull yourself together yourself, nobody else will. And it took me a couple of years somehow to recover from my injuries. And it's still not okay. My mom can testify, you know, she's over there. And that's what I can say. You know, I don't really believe in doctors, you know, as far as that goes. And they obviously, I just believe if you can't, just, you know, it takes time. You know, time helps, you know, and it was like over 2 years, and I feel like I'm somewhat recovered from it, you know.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Farber, did you continue to work during that entire period?
I had no choice, sir. Yes, I did work. I worked on 11 to 7 shift. I worked on an overnight shift where obviously I don't have to deal with public as much as I do right now, but I worked on 11 to 7 shift.
And where was that location?
I work at Hennepin County Adult Corrections Facility in Plymouth.
Plymouth?
Yes.
Did you have any other, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Farber, did you have any other responsibilities at the time besides work? I mean, did you continue to care for your mother?
Yes, sir.
For a period of time?
Yes, sir. And my mother actually did a lot, you know, she provided me emotional support. And I completely trust her. You know, she is a witness. You know, I've been calling her probably 5-6 times every day. And she would support me emotionally. And I had no other ways. You know, I mean, I had to support myself. You know, I'm not a rich individual, and I had to keep working. You know, I couldn't just say, no, I can't work. But the trauma was so devastating. I'm still surprised I survived this. You know, it was so bad.
You continue to work at that facility, right?
Yes, sir.
So I would assume that your work performance during that period of time was at least satisfactory enough that they continued to employ you, right?
Well, I met a satisfactory requirement, yes.
And do you rent? You must own. You own your home?
I own a house, yes.
Okay, and did you have a mortgage on it?
I had a mortgage on it.
Okay, and you continued to make the payments on the mortgage?
I was making payments on my mortgage. Also, when my ex, so-called ex, if you can call her that, when she left, you know, obviously, you know, she stole money from me, and she stole a vehicle.
Did you still have a car yourself now?
Yeah, I do have a car, yes.
Okay, and did you continue to have a vehicle or get a new one during that period of time?
Well, we had two vehicles, you know, and she took one vehicle, and I was left with another vehicle.
And did you have a loan on that car?
No. That's a 1985 car, so it's paid off.
You owned it, paid off.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Representative Laughlin.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Farber, since there's, as I understand it, you have a year till August 15th of the year following to file for your property tax refund, and so it appears to me that even if they'd received the mail that you put in the mailbox on April 12, 2006, your 2004 claim would have been past the year period to apply for that, so we couldn't have gone back that far anyhow, even if the mail had been received. Yeah, I think I'm correct in that, and I assume the representative from the Department of Revenue will correct me if I'm wrong. And so it's really only 1 year here that's in dispute, and the issue is not really so much it's that the mail, according to you, just didn't get delivered in time, and there's no record that it came late. Is that correct?
Well, my mistake was that I did not send it via certified mail. And, you know, my mother is a witness that I did actually drop mail in the mailbox, but apparently I didn't send it via certified mail, so I can't prove that I did do it because I sent it just via regular mail.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. If Mr. Walzer would come back up to the table.
Did you have some more questions?
I do, Mr. Walzer. I was wondering, I assume that this type of request is made fairly often with regard to considering the difficulties many senior citizens or others may have, people that may be in accidents that are kind of out of commission for a while and then discover that this type of refund may be available if they had filed it on a more timely basis. Can you give us an idea as to how many of these you deny and the department denies in a period of time? Just a rare situation?
Members of the subcommittee, it's not a rare situation. I don't have any numbers that I came prepared to give the subcommittee, but I would, my wild guess is that these types of requests might be in the hundreds, but I'd have to verify that figure. but they all get denied because, as I stated earlier, although it's called property tax refund in quotes, it's really a benefit program, and that's why the time limit is very hard and fast. There's no exception for disability or hardship. That was a legislative policy decision when this program was first enacted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olzine.
Is there any... Did you guys see if these were legitimate amounts? I mean, irregardless, if they would have been submitted in a properly or a timely manner, would they be legitimate refunds?
Walter?
Members of the subcommittee, this is an unaudited claim. And that would have been one of my suggestions, is that if this claim is allowed by the subcommittee, that the Department of Revenue verify the numbers, because as of this date, this is an unaudited claim. Because when the claim comes in late, we routinely just send out a denial that your claim has been denied because it's late. We don't go the extra mile and say, oh, by the way, if you had timely filed, this is the correct amount. They're just a flat denial.
Your hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late and missing your previous testimony, so if I'm asking you something you've already addressed, I apologize for that. But you mentioned just a moment ago that this denial of claims is a legislative policy. Is that something that is found in the statute, that there is no that there's a firm time limit to file a claim, and if it's not met, then there's no possible appeal to that? Is that something that's in statute, or is that just the policy of the department?
Walzer.
Members of the subcommittee, it is in the statute. I didn't bring my statute book with me, but it's Minnesota Statutes, Section 289A.40. And I don't remember which subdivision, but the subdivision that governs the time limit for filing a property tax refund claim has no exception in it for filing beyond that time limit in case there's some sort of reasonable cause. Whereas for a regular individual income tax refund claim, if the taxpayer can show that they suffered what's called a financial disability, which is a term that comes right from the Internal Revenue Code, so it's basically a federal determination. If they would qualify under the federal determination for being financially disabled, the time limit is suspended for filing a regular individual income tax refund claim, but not for a property tax refund, because essentially it's purely a benefit type program.
Other questions? Do you, counsel?
Mr. Chairman, I did find the statute, and it is 289A.40, subdivision 4. And it reads, it's very short, property tax refund claims is the head note. And then it says a property tax refund claim under Chapter 290A is not allowed if the initial claim is filed more than 1 year after the original due date for filing the claim.
Senator Lance.
Mr. Walzer or committee counsel, do you know if there's any case law on that question that would suspend a statute of limitations for disability, regardless of what the statutory language is?
members of the subcommittee. I am not aware of any case law. I would point out that, and I think I pointed out in the answer that I filed in response to the initial claim, that at the time Mr. Farber filed his initial claim, he still had some additional time left in which to appeal the denial of his refund claim to the Minnesota Tax Court. In other words, he could have gone to the tax court at the time he initially filed this claim. My understanding is that Mr. Farber, subsequent to when I filed my answer, he let the remaining time limit for that 60-day appeal period to go to tax court expire, and then he refiled this claim with the subcommittee. But the tax court does have a small claims division, and you know, who knows what the small claims division might do in a situation like this. They're not as stringently bound to legal precedents, perhaps, as the regular division of the tax court might be. And since this claim is under $5,000, I believe that's the amount below which you can go to the small claims division in the tax court. Sometimes the small claims division does do equity in cases like this. So I'm glad you raised that point, because it is possible that the small claims division might have awarded this claim. I don't know.
Senator Lotz.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Walzer, it sounds like the time for filing that appeal to be heard by the small claims division of the tax court has also expired as of this past October 3. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Other questions? Okay. Senator Olson.
Could Mr. Farber come back? Because I'd be curious to why he did not respond to that recommendation from the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Farber.
Yes, the reason why I did not go to Minnesota Tax Court, because there is a filing fee, I believe, of $250. I can be mistaken. And I know that what I have received from Minnesota Department of Revenue, and they said that they are bound by the statute of limitations. And I knew that in the Minnesota State Court, I will just pay $250 filing fee, and I was 100% sure that they will deny my claim, you know. And I already didn't get my refunds, and I would actually even spend more money, because there is a filing fee like $250, if I'm not mistaken. If there was no filing fee, I would have definitely gone to a tax court. But I know the tax court, I am 99.9% sure that they would deny a claim. You know, that's my own knowledge, and that's my own experience, because they are bound by the statute. This is why I decided, you know, to come over here, because I know that you may make a decision based on fairness, not just what statute says. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Walzer.
Members of the subcommittee, just a quick response to those comments. Yes, the tax court filing fee is pretty steep, but the tax court has the ability to waive that fee in cases of financial hardship. There's a Minnesota statute that would allow that to happen. I believe it's in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 563. That's point number one. And then point number two is the Small Claims Division does not issue formal written opinions. I believe they simply say yes or no to cases that are heard in small claims. So I'm sure that they would be perhaps more constricted to legal precedents and statutes of limitation than perhaps this subcommittee is, but I believe the Small Claims Division does have a little bit of discretion in cases like this.
Senator Lutz.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if either counsel would know, does the Small Claims Division of the Tax Court have the same filing fee as the regular division?
Yes, they do.
Is that in statute? Because in regular district court, Small Claims Division has a much, much lower filing fee than the $250, which is in the statute.
Mr. Walzer.
I believe it's in the... It's in the rules of the tax court.
Thank you. Senator Hand?
Mr. Chairman, and I have a question for our counsel, if she would know. Is this committee bound by the statutes and the judgments that we make, or do we have the power to set aside the statute, as we understand it, to do something other than what the statute requires?
Well, I think the charge of the committee per statute really is to do equity, and I think you would be able to, as you have, has been custom and practice in other cases, I think you would be able to consider the equities of the situation.
Senator Hand, I may be a little bit of help in that what we do is make a recommendation to the full legislature, and if the full legislature would then approve language that says notwithstanding, you know, current statutes that could circumvent current statutes. But it would not be this subcommittee. It'd be our recommendation. It'd be the full legislature and the governor that would actually make that decision. Senator Olsen.
With that being said, I would make a motion that Mr. Farber's claim be approved based upon a audit by the Department of Revenue to see if the numbers are correct. That sound like, is that the motion I want to make?
I think that gets the message across. So what you have any questions on the motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Loeffler?
I'd appreciate it if Mr. Walzer would clarify my understanding that the application for the year 2004 was late as of the date that it was mailed in. Because I thought, you know, you had to apply within a year, and I thought that year had expired at the time that he applied.
If I may respond, I believe the due date for the 2004 property tax refund return was August 15th. August 15th, let's see now. Yeah, the due date would have been August 15th of 2005 for the 04 property tax refund return. I'd like to verify that with the department before I give a firm answer to that. But I believe yes, the 1 year would have expired August 15th of 2005. That's my understanding. For the for the 04 property tax refund return.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering if, since that would be, it would definitely influence my decision, I don't think we should recognize, if he was late, even at the date he claims to have mailed it, for that 1 year, that should be taken into consideration.
Senator Lance.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, there is in our materials a notice of determination on appeal from the Minnesota Department of Revenue signed by Dwight Remmers, the supervisor in the Appeals and Legal Services Division. And it laid out that the answer to that specific question, the explanation schedule of adjustments, the original due date for the 2004 property tax refund was August 15, 2005, so August of the year after the tax year. And then the one-year anniversary date of that, which would be the statute of limitations, was August 15, 2006. And Mr. Farber filed his states that he mailed the application for that property tax refund on April 12 of 2006. So under those guidelines, he would have timely made that request for property tax refund on the 2004 refund as well as the 2005 refund. Here's from the department's own explanation.
And I think that's, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think that's consistent with what the statute says, because the initial claim must be filed by 1 year after the original date for filing the claim. So it is, you take the date and then add the original due date and add a year.
Okay, are there any more questions of either Mr. Farber or Mr. Walzer? The motion is before us. Discussion on the motion. I caution members with regard to this motion that chances are you could be setting a precedence that you're going to be seeing many more potential claims if you're able to waive a absolute deadline in statute because of the hardship that occurred. And that's not something the legislature really took into account when they in other words, they did not put that in statute. I'm sure they discussed it. I would imagine that sort of issue was dealt with. And as I believe the testimony has been, that this is a benefit, not a benefit program with a specific deadline. Assume that is, and maybe Mr. Walzer could clarify, but I would assume that is for ability for the legislature to budget for this benefit program.
That is correct. It's not a true tax refund in the sense where you've overpaid your income tax, for example. And you can show that you've overpaid your income tax, so you're asking for a refund of your own money back. The property tax refund program is somewhat based upon need, and that's why I say it is a benefit program, and it is part of the state budget process.
Any other comments or questions? Senator Lyons.
Mr. Chairman, I'm really of two minds on this one, because usually we require that people who come before the committee first of all exhaust all of their judicial or administrative remedy options before they are entitled to any recovery from us. And at least at one point there was not an exhaustion of remedies here, that is the appeal to the tax court of the administrative decision of the department. The second concern that I have has to do with whether or not a financial disability occurred here. Well, frankly, I think case law ought to read into the statute the financial disability exception to any statute of limitations. I think there's probably ample case law in other areas. Maybe it doesn't make a distinction between benefits, a benefit program, or anything else. But I think there's ample precedent in other areas of the law where the statute of limitations is stayed if someone is disabled and incapacitated during a period of time when they might otherwise file a claim. So that part doesn't bother me. But what does bother me a bit is that is whether or not there was really a financial disability here. And I fully, as I stated at the outset, I fully respect and understand the stresses that Mr. Farber might have gone through in connection with marriage. It's not just a marriage falling apart, but it's feeling totally duped into making the most important personal and emotional decision someone makes in their lifetime, probably. But on the other hand, he apparently was able to maintain his job and make payments on the mortgage on the house and presumably maintain the legal status of an automobile with insurance and all that kind of stuff. And so there might have been, looks like there's just maybe just this piece that fell through the cracks. So I'm kind of torn in the being very sympathetic toward the situation, but not entirely convinced that this would qualify, even if we had an exhaustion of remedies. So I'm not as concerned about the precedent in that regard. I'm a little concerned about that.
Another question?
Mr. Chairman, I just feel like if people use the claims committee because we have a lower filing fee than the other remedies that we've put forth, the claims committee's jurisdiction is going to grow significantly, and it is a deadline. We've had other people applied, come here for relief. It's tough, but I'm not really comfortable with setting that precedent here.
Other discussion? Hey, Senator Olsen's motion is before us to approve the claim with appropriate audits. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. No. Motion fails. Thank you very much, Mr. Farber, for bringing this issue to our attention. Thank you, Mr. Walton. Next item on our agenda is claims against the Department of Human Services. Counsel?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The first claim against the Department of Human Services is Mr. Dale Alunzi. That is a claim in the amount of $435.55. And in essence, the claim is that Mr. Lindsay's TV stand was broken at the Moose Lake facility by property inventory staff. And there doesn't seem to be much dispute about the fact that the stand was broken. However, the department at one point said they would consider a payment for the stand. But
can I ask you a question, Counsel?
Yes.
Is this particular issue coming or claim coming up for a hearing? I see that there was an indication on the Counsel's recommendation to deny the claim.
There is a Counsel's recommendation to deny the claim.
Do we have someone here that's for Mr. Lindsay to testify on this, or is there a reason to pull this particular one out? I think that what I'd like to do is focus on those that we want to have a hearing on, okay, rather than going through. Unless there's objection by members, we can go through each one in detail if you prefer.
But we don't need to do that as far as I'm concerned.
Well, okay. Senator Latz.
I did have a question about this particular claim,
okay,
Mr. Chairman. I note that the District Court Judge Wolf and denied the claim, but he didn't do it on the merits. He denied it for other reasons relating to jurisdiction. So, to me, that's not persuasive on how to handle the case. And I also note that the department had agreed to pay for the damage that they caused, but then it appears that later on they went ahead and denied even that. So do we know what dollar amount is connected to the damage the department acknowledges they caused?
No, I think that is another one of the problems with the claim, that Mr. Lindsay claimed the entire cost of the television because apparently it came with the stand. But I think clearly the stand would not be worth the total amount of the claim. But there isn't, I don't see any facts in the claim as to how much the stand is actually worth.
Mr. Chairman?
Right.
There's nothing I saw in the documents here that said that the TV itself was inoperable. The only information seemed to suggest the TV was still fine. It didn't fall off the stand and break.
No, it was the stand itself.
It was just the stand.
Yeah.
I'd be inclined to grant the claim in the amount of buying a new stand or repairing the stand so that it could hold the TV. Apparently the part is no longer available, and I'm not sure what exactly the technical solution there would be. But if we could somehow get a dollar figure for that, I think that's only fair.
Okay. We have Department of Human Services?
I think she's just returning. She was here just a minute ago. So I'll check. She was just plugging her meter.
Okay.
All right. I'll ask the court reporter to read back my comments when she gets here.
If we could, why don't we set that one aside for just a moment then and go on to... it's my understanding, counsel, that there's a Cerna, Louis Cerna, is recommended for pay?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is the next one on the agenda, and Mr. Lindeke did recommend that for payment. That is a situation in which Mr. Cerna claims the TV was damaged in a move, and the department's response seemed to indicate that Mr. Cerna was responsible for packing it, and the department said that he should have used bubble wrap, and that the damage to the television essentially was the claimant's fault. And so on that basis, as well as some other legal reasons, the department did deny the claim. But I think Mr. Lindeke was concerned about saying that the claimant should have moved it himself or done a better packing job, and thought that you should recommended that you should hear the case and actually recommended payment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Is Department of Human Services covered? Didn't we have some kind of a, maybe it's for Department of Corrections where they have a specific TV, and I'm just wondering if Department of Human Services has a limit on, I mean, because I thought we were trying like $150 or something for TVs last year. And this seems like it's a little higher. So I'm wondering if there's a, if they have restrictions on the TVs that are allowed or not. That just seems kind of nice.
Identify yourself for the record.
Okay. My name is Ngozi Chukwu Akubike, from the Department of Human Services, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. The Department of Human Services has a limit as to size of TV, but I don't believe we have a limit as to amount, the value of TV.
Can I
the patients can have.
Do you have requirements like DOC where they have to be clear screen so that contraband can't be hidden in the TV, or is there no requirement like that?
Yeah, I believe we do. We have policy on contraband, which I didn't bring. There are certain things patients are not allowed to have.
So are their TVs all clear plastic then, so you can see through them?
I'm not sure.
Because that's what we find with DOC, is that their TVs have to be of a clear plastic so they can see if anything's being hidden in there. So, and I think there's only a few TVs like that, so maybe you guys don't have that policy, or you probably would know about it.
I'm not sure about whether Claire TV, I'm not sure about it. I'm sure about the size of the TV.
Hey, if you'd like to, we're discussing this Lewis Cerna claim. Do you have anything to add?
Yes, the Department of, like every state agency, we have risk management that processes claims for patients to establish whether there is negligence on our part or on the part of the state or its employees. Risk management is independent of Department of Human Services. So risk management did their own investigation and found that Mr. Cerna did not do what he was supposed to do. He was giving the things that he needed to put the TV, the bubbles, but he chose not to do that. And that's part of patient responsibility. But he did not do that, and because of that, risk management denied Mr. Cerna's claim. And also, we are relying on the statute that says that the state and its employees are not responsible for any damage or loss to patient property.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where would a patient get bubble wrap to wrap up a TV to comply with what your expectation? Is there a store that would sell that they would have access to, or how would they get that material?
The facility provided that whenever a patient is moving and needs to move.
So the department gave the wrapping material to Mr. Cerna?
Yes.
Prior to the move.
Yeah. But instead of using that, he dumped everything together with his property and his TV was damaged in the process.
Senator or Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Akawuki, sorry if I'm saying that wrong. The claim notes that this is the third TV that's been broken, at least claimed by, and this is the only one in which he has filed a claim because he just kind of got worn out at buying new TVs. And if you have any knowledge of whether that's a true or false situation, that would be useful. But the other thing is, having helped many people move, I don't recall anyone ever seeing bubble wrapping a TV. They usually come with a handle, or it actually feels like it'd be safer to carry it without having poorly taped bubble wrap around it. So I'm just kind of amazed that that's the criteria by which you decide whether or not it's movable. I'm just kind of surprised. It doesn't tell us, I don't think, how big the TV is or whatever, but I'm just not sure if that's a practical solution given the nature of how you might tape things and not have it work anyhow. But do you know anything about his statements that he has had other TVs broken in previous moves within the facility?
I have no knowledge of his prior TVs being damaged. But this is the one that came to our attention, and it was forwarded to risk management to do the investigation. And others used the same thing, and we didn't receive any complaints. And he's the one that did not use, and his TV was damaged. So while I do not have a way of saying for a certainty, his TV would not have damage, but we have other instances of other patients that used the same, and they did not have their TV damaged.
Other questions, Senator Alcine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the procedure is that they're provided a tote or something to put this in, and that's where the bubble wrap would protect it from bouncing around within the tote or box?
A box, boxes and bubble wrap, yeah.
Okay, so the statement is from your department that he chose to place his television with the rest of his items instead of using boxes. What does that mean? Was it on a cart or a tote or... Did he move to a different facility or within the same facility?
He moved to a different facility. At times they are moved from St. Peter to Moose Lake, from Moose Lake to St. Peter, so in the process of that move.
Can you clarify what that means, though? He chose to place his television with the rest of its items instead of using the boxes or bubble wrap provided. Does that mean he just threw them in a tote or
in what? A box along with other items that he has, other personal items.
Oh, okay. A follow-up, if I may, is there any estimate to repair his television? Because I think he was saying in there that he doesn't really care if he gets a new one or he gets the other one repaired. He just wants, I guess, you know, to be able to watch his television.
So. We didn't get any estimate about how much it will cost to repair. No. Because we felt it was his responsibility to pack his things and use what we provided for him, and he made a choice not to use the things we provided for his move.
Sorry, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where is this TV now?
I'm not sure where the TV is. Usually when they are broken, they are kept in a particular place. And after a while, the patient is notified to move, because by that time, it would have been, if it's not being used and for space, they may ask him to send it out of the facility. So I'm not sure if he has sent it out of the facility to relatives or if he's still in the storage room. But I would doubt that he will be in the storage room.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I was trying to get at his claim that he's not been returned the TV after the move. Just is that the case that he TV was broken and then because of that not returned to him?
Or? Yeah, it wouldn't be returned to him. It would either be in the storage or he would be given notice to ship it out.
So he can't have access to it to see if it works, for example, or to see if he could still watch it even if it was broken?
It must have been determined that it was broken. The staff, if a patient complains about TV being broken, they will check it, and if it's actually broken at that point, it will be contraband. They won't be able to use it because broken TV could be used as a weapon.
Mr. Chair, it states here that he moved from, I'm assuming that MSOP or whatever is Moose Lake, or is that St. Peter? He said, I was moved from the MSOP main building to the annex building.
Okay, yeah, both of them are in Moose Lake, but there's the annex that is close to the DOC facility.
Okay. So it wasn't a move then between St. Peter, mm-hmm. So it was relatively short distance.
Yes.
Senator Lutz.
Mr. Chairman, ma'am, so it sounds like he's not going to get the TV back in its present condition, even if it's still there. It had some broken plastic on it that could be used as a weapon, so it's either got to be repaired or replaced. But he's not getting it back in its present condition,
no.
Right?
No.
So I'd be inclined to let the department either repair or replace it at their discretion.
Other questions? Is there anyone here? Louis Serna, testify on this.
Okay. May I say something?
Yes.
Like we said, the law says we are not responsible, and in this case, we believe that the patient did not do what he's supposed to do in the first instance, resulting in the damage to the property. If a patient in this instance, when he's supposed to do something and he did not do it, and the state is asked to pay, it will be opening door to a whole lot of other claims, that, especially from the sex offender program, that the committee may not be able to handle. That's what I will have to say.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, just again to clarify, if he had taken the bubble wrap that was provided and wrapped it around the TV and put it in the box that was provided and it was damaged, would the department honor the claim in that condition then, in that circumstance? Just is that the thing that is the sticking point here, is that he didn't follow the procedure that was provided for him and
prior to the move, but had he done that and the damage still occurred, would the department then say, well, we'll pay the cost?
At the time of the claim, that would have been, it would have been possible, but now the department has taken a position that they will abide by the law that says they are not responsible and will not be making payments for any damage to patients' property. So at the time of this claim, the department may have, but now, no, that's the policy the department has.
And Mr. Chairman, can it just, has there been frequent claims of damage to property and moves by against the department? Is this a common occurrence, the things that he's describing, or is this very unusual? Does this happen frequently that in the course of a move of a patient, things get damaged? And just I'm trying to get a feel for how unique the circumstance may be.
Once in a while we don't get a whole lot of claims from patients, but once in a while we do get claims from patients. And also you need to understand in the MSOP program we have about 300 patients. So comparing the number and the claims is very low.
Has there been a lot of TVs that have gotten moved, and is this the only one that's gotten damaged, or is this...
There have been TVs that have been moved, and I think there have been about two or three that we received about TVs that were damaged.
Were those wrapped in bubble wrap as well? Or
no, those issues didn't even come up. I think it was the staff handling lifting or something that caused it to cause the damage. But, you
know. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Abuki. I must say that I'm a little concerned about a policy that says we're just going to not take responsibility for damage to patients' property, point blank. And I was struck by the articulateness of actually the claimant in saying that this is the third time that these people have broken my TVs and I have not been paid for the damage. I am taught in this treatment program to be accountable for my mistakes and wrongs and to own up to my mistakes. So I own up to my mistakes, but when is these people, it's his writing, are going to take responsibility for the damages they have done to my TVs? I do not have the money to keep on buying myself a new TV every time they take the TV for shakedowns or by moving me and my property. And I'm somewhat compelled by the fact that these are people who are committed. They have no free choice. They're there for what may be forever. It's one of the most expensive programs that across the country, so there's a lot of staff supervision, a lot of financial support for the facility. And, you know, it seems like we get these complaints where people who, through no choice of their own, are being moved and have no option of moving their own things, have things damaged, and in their own little world, the things that they have been bought for them by people outside or that they've been able to secure funds to buy are pretty precious. And so I'm concerned about a blanket policy that just says, in general, someone who is a patient, we're not going to take responsibility for their belongings. And that may send a message to staff who may be frustrated with particular residents that, you know, this can be... It's okay to not treat their things with respect, even though they're a patient and, in theory, they're there for treatment, not for punishment. And so I have I'm somewhat sympathetic to this claim just because of the way it's written, and I do think I'd like to send a message that we really do think you have to honor the belongings of the people who are entrusted to your care.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the policy is not an arbitrary policy. It's based on the law. When management, we pointed out to them the statute exempting the state and its employees from liability, the decision is, the choice is either to follow the law or ignore it. And management chose to follow the law that says that the state and will leave it up to the individual. The individual has a recourse either to go to court Even when we receive the claim as well, we send it on to state risk management, who will make an independent investigation, and which risk management did in this instance, made an independent investigation, found out that it was due to the patient's patient not taking responsibility, not taking using the items provided for him for the move. And regarding moving from a facility, one facility to the other, there may be a number of reasons for moving a patient. It could be that the patient is moving up to the next level and the patient may move from one facility to the other. It could be because there was a problem in the patient's behavior and he will be moved to a different area. So like those who are participating in treatment, they are in a particular area. Those who are not participating, or somebody participating in treatment and decides, I don't want to participate in treatment, they will be moved to the area where people who are not participating in treatment are. So it's not when patients are moved from one unit to the other, it's not an arbitrary decision. There could be a number of reasons for that.
Mr. Chair? General Singh.
Are these... I'm trying to find some relevance in my mind here. Are these the $800 a day people?
I don't know which one. Which one is
okay.
The $800?
I guess that's irrelevant. But I guess I would make a motion then that Department of Human Services either repair or replace this television at their discretion.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, the Senator Rolstein's motion is before us to direct the department to repair or replace the television. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Members, I'd also like to mention, this came up, I think, last time we had a hearing, and that this the department is now pulling out the particular statute words, and I think it's because of the change in staff that they have a different policy at the Department of Human Services than what was practiced in the past. I think that technically it's the current policy is correct with regard to statutes, with regard to saying that there isn't any liability. But I don't know anywhere that we have legislated against compassion and justice. And I think that we should, that I would encourage the Claims Committee to look into this particular statute and find out what the real intent was and to see if the literal interpretation that the department is currently taking is really what the legislature intended. I think they were giving some blanket liability there so that this loss of or damage to destruction of property could not be used against the state of Minnesota someone may choose to try and punish the state for whatever actions. But I don't think that it was the legislature's intent. I doubt it was legislature's intent to just say, well, we're going to automatically deny the claims, regardless of the circumstances, and that's what I hear the testimony is from the department. If I'm incorrect, please bring that to my attention.
Yeah.
But it's my understanding that the department is now just saying we're denying, period. And I don't think that's really the intent of that particular statute. I won't be here, but I really encourage you might take a look at that and make certain that that's... if you might have a recommendation to the legislature on how to bring a little more understanding and fairness into that particular phrase.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts.
On that point, I would also note that saying that someone can go to court, given the language in that statute, is really a false claim.
Yes.
What good does it do to go to court if the court's only option is to rule that the state is immune from liability? So we are, in fact, the court of last resort.
I think the department is interpreting the current statute correctly. It's just that I don't know that that's exactly what the legislature intended, and they put that blanket language in there. At least the practices I've known in the past have had a little more compassion and understanding in the decisions rather than just a blanket no.
I think Craig was working on that the last time about doing something about the law, so you may want to check to know how far it's gone.
Mr. Chairman, I will follow up, and I do recall that this issue came up once before, and Mr. Lindeke would give the advice that he did not think the statute was an absolute exclusion that the committee could not consider in light of particular facts and equities.
It was to me that the statute was there for a legal umbrella for the state to be under. But it didn't say that that's exactly the position the state always has to take. And yet that's the way it's being interpreted. And I think that there's a little more flexibility must need to be articulated in the statute in order to bring some common sense back to the table. Let's go revert back to the Dale Lindsay claim. And Senator Latz had some questions regarding that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll note that Judge Wolf's decision denying the claim was on jurisdictional grounds, not on the merits of the claim. In fact, it was on exactly the jurisdictional grounds that the department was asserting in the matter we just resolved, which was that the tort claim statute did not allow compensation for the loss of damage or destruction of property. And that was the basis for his denying uniform pauperis petition to proceed in court, even to be heard on the merits. On the other hand, the department had previously agreed to pay for the damage they caused until they later acquired a waiver from the claimant, which seems a bit dubious to me under the circumstances. In any case, it sounds like the department acknowledged that they broke the TV stand. I don't know if the TV itself is still in the possession of the claimant or not. And I'm not certain how critical the stand is to the ability to use the TV, or you can put the TV on some other holder. But in any case, I'd be inclined here to require the state to pay for the repair of the TV stand that they acknowledge that they broke, and they're not claiming that it was due to any negligence or a failure on the part of the claimant. And if they're unable to repair it, that they go ahead and replace it and the TV if necessary to facilitate the use of the TV.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I want to point out that to clear the record that the waiver was not obtained dubiously. The waiver was obtained in 2006, and that wasn't when this claim came up. And also, like other claims, risk management with Department of Admin also investigated and came to the conclusion that the Department of Human Services is not responsible for the damage. So, again, we are relying on the same law that says that the state and its employees are not responsible. Our hands are tied because of the law. We are obligated to follow the statute.
So I can better understand that position. Why do you think the legislature established a claims committee?
I would like to find out why. But my understanding is that you look into claims that the courts ordinarily would not handle, in addition to other reasons why you handled claims. And again, we feel that this is something that the court also can handle. So I really am interested in knowing why they, other than the equity I've heard today and the claims that courts ordinarily would not handle, it would be a nice educational opportunity for me to know other reasons why the subcommittee was established in the first instance.
Senator Lass.
Mr. Chairman, ma'am, I'm looking at a letter dated March 13, 2008 from Edmond, Minnesota, Department of Risk Management, in which it says that patients, the sex offender program patients, are asked to sign a waiver of claim for damages form at the time of admission to the program. Mr. Lindsay, the claimant, says that they are made to sign that waiver when they come into the program in order to obtain any of their property. And I don't understand this. If someone is court ordered to be in this program, they have no choice under the law to be there. It sounds to me like either they are under duress, they're not going to be admitted into the program unless they sign the waiver, or if their personal property is held hostage to that waiver. Maybe there's something I'm not understanding here, but maybe you can explain to me, ma'am, what the basis is for a waiver then in this program.
When a patient is ordered to participate in the sex offender program or is civilly committed as either sexually dangerous person or somebody with sexual psychopathic personality, we have no option not to admit that person. So it's inaccurate for a patient to say we wouldn't admit him or her because he failed to sign a waiver. No. It's not accurate at all.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Lass. Actually, the patient here says he was made to sign when they came into the program in order to obtain any of our property. Now, that's the patient's language. The department, Admin Minnesota's language, is that the patients are asked to sign a waiver claim at the time of admission, a waiver of claim for damages form. So describe to me what the waiver form is and what its purpose is and when they are requested to sign it.
Honestly, that's the when I got the claim, that's when I learned about the waiver, and I don't think that waiver is still still exists at this time. It may have been because of the nature of the patients that we have. They can come up with a number of things, and maybe the staff at that time felt it was necessary. In my own opinion, it wasn't necessary at all. Based on the law, the law is the foundation that we have to make a decision whether or not to pay for the loss or damage of patient's property. And prior to management taking the stand, DHS, some facilities pay, some will not pay based on the circumstances and the facts of the case. So, but now, like I said, it's blanket all over the facilities. It's been communicated to all facilities in the state that they are not going to make the, they shouldn't be making the, or approving the payment for any loss items of patients.
Mr. Chairman? So is it in fact the policy now of DHS that if a staff person intentionally throws a patient's TV on the floor and breaks it, that the department is not going to compensate the patient for the damage to their property?
The department would not tolerate any such from the employees. And again, that's why there is that level and independent investigation. We do not investigate these claims. Once we receive them, we send them over to risk management. That's why there is that independent investigation. Risk management works on behalf of the Attorney General's office to make a determination whether there is any wrongdoing on our part. But the department will not tolerate an employee willfully destroying a patient's property, no.
But it sounds like, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like the department is saying you're not going to pay the claim because you don't have to under the statute. I have to take a look and see, there might be an exception to the tort claim statute to intentional acts. But even if it were gross negligence, or if it were negligence, if an employee walks in and says, your TV can't be over here, it's got to be over here, picks up the TV to move it and drops it, unintentionally, but clearly the employee's fault, not the patient's fault. Are you saying that the department will stand behind its immunity provision on the statute and will not compensate the patient for the loss of property?
To answer your question, I think we need to understand the nature of the DHS we are talking about is the state-operated services that has facilities about 300 in the state. So what happens is that each facility can make an independent. In the past, each facility can make an independent decision.
So you're saying now the facilities aren't going to make their own decisions?
No.
Everything's going
to
be referred
everything
to risk
comes
management.
comes to the central office and sent to risk management to conduct an independent investigation to find out what really happened in that instance. So we'll wait for risk management to give us their decision and then tell the patient, this is what we will do in this instance and this is what we will not do.
So you may or may not pay, depending on the outcome of the risk management investigation?
Depending on the outcome of, in the first place, the decision is no payment at all, then we wait for risk management. Is it a willful act on the part of the employee? It's different from negligence. You know, we are talking about negligence here. So willful act and negligence, they're different.
So if the investigation by risk management concludes that the department employee was negligent, then you will decline to pay under the Tort Claims Act?
Yeah, if it says the employee is not negligent, if it says the employee is negligent, we will not pay. If it's willful, then it's a different level of decision that management has to make in deciding whether to pay or not.
Under what circumstances have you paid since this new policy has gone in place?
I think we made I think there's one that came that we made out of our St. Peter office that we paid. That was either a boom box. Yeah. That may have been Rocio, yeah, that came through your office that we paid.
Came through where?
Through the subcommittee.
Okay, one that we've approved.
No, you didn't approve. He sent the claim to you, to the subcommittee, and we received them and reviewed and said, oh, this case, we need to, the facility made a decision, pay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Ms. Ibuki, whenever you have a situation in which someone has total control over someone else's life and care, you always are at risk of somebody taking advantage of that. And we've seen it, unfortunately, recently in the press with nursing homes, privately operated, chosen by family members. Anyone can get employees who do bad things and who abuse the trust that's been put into them. And I
I have a sense that particularly with these facilities, while we use the language patients, sometimes it feels more like inmate in terms of their scope of decision-making and freedom, and perhaps sometimes the attitudes of society towards the people, particularly in the sex offender program. And it just feels like part of the role of the claims committee and the internal process is to be a quality check on whether or not the right atmosphere and appropriate respect is given to the people whose lives have been committed there. And it bothers me a bit that the agency seems to be kind of taking itself out of that quality oversight role and having risk management doing that, and that there seems to be kind of a rigid, unless it's a really an exception, the resident is wrong, kind of an approach that the state's protected by this law that says, you know, nothing can. And so I'm just a little concerned, and I don't think that's what you intended to say, but I do think that we have an issue here about, you know, what is the basic role of having an independent outside review for people who are in that kind of a situation, and should the first line of defense be within the department, and then should it go to risk management, or what's the layers?
Can I respond to that? First of all, we do not the number or the type of patients that we serve, they cross, it's not only the sex offenders. We have adolescents. We have people who come in voluntarily. We also have people who are committed to us. And going to the another layer of investigation that you mentioned, risk management, it's by law, we are asked not to settle patients' claim at all. We are not allowed to settle on our own patients' claim by law. And what the Attorney General's office have done, instead of the Attorney General's office doing the investigation, they have sent it to risk management to conduct investigation when there is a claim, a tort claim, by a patient. So it's not something that we on our own made the decision that, look, risk management, you'll be the one doing it. It is by law. We are not allowed to settle any patient's claim on our own. It has to be investigated by risk management.
Chair? Senator Olsen.
I would move that the Department of Human Services either repair or replace with a similar model the TV stand that's been damaged.
Okay, and do you want to... if this needs to be incorporated into a part of a our bill, that the claims bill that goes before the legislature, do you want it to include language that says notwithstanding the particular section of law that the department keeps referring to?
It's a very friendly amendment. Thank you.
As we can trump that law. The motion... Senator Olsen, is that to repair or replace the damaged TV stand, notwithstanding?
And then a similar should probably be in there because I think they said that model's not available anymore. So
same or similar. Okay. Very good. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we vote, I wanted to just go back to clarify this waiver that we have a copy of in our materials. It seemed that you said that the department no longer requires a waiver to be signed. Is that correct, or did I misunderstand?
No such waiver being used.
So this waiver that was executed in 2006 is no
way back 2006.
Is it the waiver language? And I understand you're saying it's no longer used, but it says that the program gives permission to the people who are in the facility to have personal property. Is that is it the policy generally that people who are admitted to these facilities have no right to personal property but are granted permission to have personal property under certain circumstances? Is that a fair reading of that language? Is that kind of, if someone is committed, they have no right to say, well, I want this, this, and this. They are only allowed to have what the department determines that they should have. Is that, how does that work?
Not they have a right to property, but because of space, they have there's a limited number of quantity that they can have. For they are asked to, they are given some input. I don't remember the number that they are to have to keep their property. So they choose, except for things that are not contraband. So if they are contraband, they are not allowed to use it. If they are not contraband, they are allowed to use.
And Mr. Chairman, again, just to clarify here, again, going back to the waiver, one of the sections says that the advantages of liability insurance have been discussed, and I understand you're saying they no longer do this, but do patients have the ability to decide when they're admitted to these programs that they want to have an insurance policy to cover all their personal belongings? Is that something, an option that is available to them if they choose it?
I don't know.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is if someone is committed to this program and is allowed to have certain property but not allowed to take any reasonable measures to protect that property. And it would seem to me, if the department is saying that they have no liability either, that presents a pretty unusual circumstance for someone. Either if they're allowed to have property but not allowed to take any steps to protect the value of that property, that I'm not confused by that, I guess, position.
I'm not sure what steps they are to take, but I can find out what steps or measures.
If the department's position is that the law says that there is no liability that can be assumed by the department, then it would seem to me that there ought to be some facility to permit or encourage individuals to protect their property through their own agency.
Insurance. I can find out if we allow that, and I can send that response back.
Any other questions on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The department is directed to take care of it. I would, before we go to our next one, I would like to ask, you've made a statement that your department is prohibited from paying. And I'd like to know where that statute is located.
That's the Minnesota Statute 3, Chapter 3. We can settle the claims without the Attorney General's approval when it comes to patients. For employees, that I think that has been increased to either $750 or $500. For patients, we are not allowed to.
Where do you find that statute that says you are not allowed to?
It's Chapter 3. Of
Is that 3.7?
I don't have the
3.6 subdivision 3.
I don't have the exact site.
Because as I read it, it doesn't go that far. What it does actually state is that without intent to preclude the courts from finding additional cases where the state or its employees should not, in equity and good conscience, pay compensation for personal injuries or property loss, the legislature declares that the state and its employees are not liable for the following losses.
Not that one.
That's not it?
No, that, okay. The one that sets a limit.
I'd appreciate you, if you can, at some point, find that for me.
Is
the
one
next one do we want to counsel?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think following your earlier direction, I don't think the committee would need to hear the Stephen Russo or the Chris Syme claims. Those had very strong recommendations for denial from Mr. Lindeke. The Russo one, the court, district court, has already dealt with the matter and found no negligence on the part of the state. And the Syme one is a property destruction claim where the claimant had plenty of opportunity to send the property out. So those can be denied without hearing it. That would be the pleasure of the committee.
And members, I believe the recent past practice has been that the committee subcommittee actually has a motion to either deny or accept. And I failed to do that on the first issue that was before us today. We had a motion to see if there was support to pay
when it failed, I did not call for the second motion to deny, and so we may need to go back and revisit that first one. But is there a motion to deny the two that council just Stephen
so
Rosen and Chris Syme?
Mr. Chair, move denial.
Representative Loeffler moves to deny those two. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, there is one more then that was added in, and it's the Bruce Wollen, W-O-L-L-A-N claim, and it was in the secondary packet that you just received today. That is one that Mr. Lindsay recommended that you hear. This, too, is another damage to television claim. But this one is a little different. The claimant claims that he asked to purchase a power strip with a surge protector for his television, and that he was denied the request to purchase that. And then around August 15th of 2008, there was an electrical surge that blew out the circuits in the TV. And Mr. Lindeke was, I think, raising some of the questions here that we've been talking about. Why should the, because the department said the claimant should go to court, but then the court would then most likely rely on the Tort Claims Act and the provision that we've been looking at with the exclusion for damage to property of a patient or inmate. And recommended that you hear it. So.
Okay, Department.
I received a follow-up questions to this. The first one, is whether there was a power surge. Now we have checked, there was no power surge. We have three independent records, and we have no proof. Any evidence of power surge on August 15th. The second one is whether his TV was actually damaged. We received complaints from the employee, from the patient, that he had problems with his TV. But we and asked that we pay him. We denied because we had order about. First of all, there was no evidence of power surge. Secondly, we had about 58 patients in that particular unit, and none of them had any problem with their TV. The state also has at least a minimum of four TVs in the same unit, and none of them has any problem. So we felt that this is not a claim that we need to settle.
Okay. Any questions? I'd find it also very odd that you have one TV that would be affected by a power surge, and something like that should affect everything within the unit. And I don't know what you'd do if they all got blown out. So.
With no deductible.
Any motion on this particular one?
Move to deny.
Our last moves to deny Bruce Wollen claim. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Claim is denied. The I'd like to go back to that the first claim that we had today. Uri Farber, and we had that a motion before us that did not prevail that was asking to pay the claim. We do have a practice now of bringing up the opposite motion if members so desire, and I did not present that opportunity to members. If there is a motion to deny, someone would like to make that motion.
Chairman, I'll move a motion to deny the claim of Uri Farber.
Representative Loeffler moves to deny the Uri Farber claim.
Any questions on that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Claim is denied. Next, we go to claims against the Department of Administration. And Iron Range Resources.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. The next case is the claim of Aaron Cross. And this is a personal injury claim. The claimant was injured during a bike race at Giants Ridge Ski Area in 1991. And apparently, he collided with the back of a race vehicle, and which left him with some very serious personal injuries. And this matter did go to court, and you can see in your materials there is actually a special verdict in which a jury made the determination that there was no negligence on the part of Giants Ridge. Oh, and I should indicate that the state action here, the state connection, is that Giants Ridge, well, I don't know if it is still, but at least at the time, it was under the auspices of the IRRRB, and that is the state connection in this case. Despite the court action, the claimant has come forward, and we recommended that this case be heard, although Mr. Lindeke did recommend a denial because of the court decision, but there were some really substantial injuries here.
Okay. Let's see. I think in this case, while we hear from the claimant, is someone here to represent Mr. Cross?
Yes, sir.
Like to come forward and identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, sir. My name is Aaron Cross. I'm currently in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
Okay. And if you'd like to explain your claim.
17 years ago, I was involved with a miscommunication with a van. I was in a bicycle race. I was training for the Olympic cycling team. I was in a event that was just supposed to be a fun bike race for a training event. And during that event, a support vehicle got in between me and nine other riders. And as I was chasing those nine riders down, someone in the front pack of nine popped a tire. Doing what he was supposed to do, the driver of the support vehicle stopped to help that rider out. But what he did not do was pull off the road. I came around the corner going about 38 miles an hour. I slammed into the back of the van and snapped my neck into three different spots, and it paralyzed me instantly. I'm what's known in the medical community as a functional quadriplegic. Technically paralyzed from the neck down, I do have limited use of my arms, limited use of my hands. Basically paralyzed from the armpits down. During that time, went through extensive rehab up in St. Luke's Hospital, down here at Abbott Northwestern Hospital, through Sister Kenny. Basically restarted the life all over again. During that time, we did do a lawsuit. And through that time, my understanding was is that we could never go after the state of Minnesota because basically the state could do no wrong. Those are just my words. And throughout this time, have battled to just make the ends meet. And in all honesty, this has come about because of, and tragically because of, the I-35 bridge. Claims were being made against the state, and that brought up an idea to me to finally be able to go after the state, saying that it was in fact an event that was held on by a state park. It was run by a state employee who did not inform proper race etiquette, and because of that, I am now in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. I've lived a life, but it is certainly not the life that I wanted to live. And because of that, now we took a chance and asked for the committee's assistance or views, if you will.
Okay. Any questions? Sir Lutz.
Thank you. Mr. Cross, thank you for appearing before us today. Appreciate
thank you.
Taking the time to be here. I've read through all the materials that we've received in connection with this, your specific claim, or your statement of the claim, and Minnesota Department of Administration's response. It seemed to me, I just want to clarify something. You already went to a jury trial on this, and the jury found that the state was not negligent at the time of the accident. But even before going to the jury trial, you did enter into a high-low agreement with the state of Minnesota by and through the IRRRB, right? In which they agreed to pay one value if you won and one value if you lost. You lost and you got paid according to that agreement that you signed. And so I'm having difficulty seeing how making the claim before us is consistent with abiding by the agreement that you signed at the time of that that legal action.
Senator Latz, my understanding from the thing, I was 15 when we had that accident, so my anger and hostility of what had happened railroaded my life. So to understand all the legal obligations and exactly what happened, I can be honest with you, I can't honestly answer that. That's why I actually asked my uncle to be here, because he was always at my family's side. The reason why we did the high-low agreement, to my knowledge, was because we were told by our lawyers if we did not do one of those things, we were going to basically lose. And that meant we were going to lose our house and everything else along with it. Just because from my understanding, and this I could be wrong, but my understanding was the state could then go after us for all the medical bills that they've already paid, and which would have consumed our home and all our savings and everything. So we went after the high-low agreement. That is my understanding why we signed that high-low thing with the lawyers.
Mr. Chairman.
Mayor Lutz.
Mr. Cross, in addition to the payment made in accordance with the high-low agreement, the state did pay medical bills on your behalf as well, is that right?
To be honest, Senator Latz, I don't remember. I think that is correct.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Cross, thank you for coming for us today. I wanted to just get some clarification of a statement that you made, that you decided after this length of time to come to the Claims Committee because of the situation involving the 35W bridge. What was it about that circumstance that caused you to reconsider or to think that this would be an appropriate time to what are the things, the circumstances related to the bridge that relate to your case that lead you to be here?
I think I can.
Excuse me, if you'd like to come to the table, sorry. Please.
My name's Steve Cross.
Grab a chair there. And
just be for a moment. I just want to
identify yourself for the record, please.
My name's Steve Cross. I'm the uncle of Aaron. And I can answer directly because it was at my suggestion, largely, and it is solely because of the prominence. Interstate 35 bridge fall has nothing to do with his precise case. It was only because it came to my attention that the claim committee existed because of that. And I asked at that time, you know, did you guys, when you were represented by counsel, ever go to the Claims Commission? Was told that the answer was no, and I then suggested that he go to the go here to the Claims Commission. So the fact that he's here now is because of my suggestion, and my suggestion was because of it coming to my attention because of the claims against the state because of the I-35. There's no causal connection. It's just a matter of how he got here today.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, Mr. Cross, the prior to that event, your knowledge of the existence of the Claims Committee was absent. You did not know that there was such a committee?
No, I have prior knowledge of the that sort of thing, but he was represented by counsel, and I assume counsel was taking care of those kinds of considerations. Apparently, counsel was not.
Okay.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You were, like you said, you were like 15 years old or so when the court case was up. Were your some thoughts about why, I think it was 49% for the driver of the car, 51% negligence on your part, and zero on the Giants Ridge. Do you have any thoughts on why the jury made that decision, that there was no negligence on the part of the event holder?
Senator Olsen, I was in college at the time that the court case went through. I was injured when I was 15, May of 91. I was in college, I think it went to court 94, 95, to be honest. I do not remember. But I was not there during the whole court proceedings because my parents would not let me miss the college. So I was not there at all times, but I cannot justify as to what other people were thinking. Nevertheless, whatever they were thinking, it was a state park. It was a state employee, and that state employee was running the race, and that state employee did not inform the volunteers of how to properly do the race. And because of that, I'm in a wheelchair today. So I cannot vouch for what the jury was thinking. All I know, I was there to race and I was there to win. And because of the mistake of somebody else, I'm here.
Okay. Other questions? Anyone from the Department of Administration want to is here?
I'm with the department.
Okay. I think that I have a tendency to lay this over and get a little more information if we can, unless the committee feels that they're ready to deal with this issue now. What are your suggestions,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Latz.
What information do you feel that we are lacking at this time?
I don't know the all the circumstances other than what I've read in this little piece of paper. I don't know that that's any additional is necessary. And so I just wanted to make sure that the committee had that option of gathering more information if you need it. If you don't, I feel ready to vote, but I didn't know if others are.
Mr. Chairman and members, I just wanted to indicate that there is a statement that was received, I think, by Nicole, this morning or just this morning from the Iron Range Resources Board, and that was in the supplemental packet that Nicole prepared for you. So there is that statement. I also spoke to a representative of the Attorney General's office who indicated to me that it was not the policy of the Attorney General's office to come and represent an agency, but my understanding was a member of risk management was to be here today. And I don't know if there is a...
Our understanding is
that was what we were all told, that somebody from the Department of Administration Risk Management would be here, but apparently there is not a representative. from that department.
Excuse me, subcommittee. I have not received anything. I would appreciate it either to be read out loud or allow me to read it from whatever has been said by the Iron Range.
I believe Diane has a copy for you.
I guess I would, Mr. Chair.
General C.
I would make a motion to lay this on the table to our next meeting so that somebody from the risk management can be there. Was it risk management?
Yes, it was risk management, of the, which is part of the Department of Administration in the executive branch.
Because, you know, I'm feeling that this was a many years ago incident that has gone through court and probably gone through all the proper channels, but I think it would be important for them to kind of defend their position, or at least give us their position. That's my motion that we look in, set this aside.
And my sense is that there's some significant precedents that could be established here, and I don't know that we know all those potential ramifications. Senator Alcyon, I can take your motion if you prefer. I think underneath the authority of the chair, I can just lay this over.
That'd
unless there's objection.
No,
and that way you won't have to go through the formal formality of taking it off the table.
That would be fine. Thank you.
Okay. Senator
Hand. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm just looking for clarification maybe from you or counsel. Is it – I'm trying to recall in my relatively short tenure here on the committee, if we've heard claims that have been adjudicated by a court and settled, or is this the first time we've had this circumstance presented to the claims committee? And I'm just asking. I don't recall offhand that we have, but I'm a little bit concerned that we have had a matter that has gone to court, been settled, and then is being asked to be reviewed by the claims committee, which would, to my way of thinking, put us above the court in terms of our ability to adjudicate a matter, and I'm not certain where that puts us. And so is that something you can respond to? Is this an unusual situation that we're being asked to look at?
And, Senator Hand, our in-house historian is not here today. So my experience would be of limited value to you. So I would really think we should maybe hold that question for a future time also. That's all right. Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and to members, I think it's fine for us to get additional information, but I really want us to get some good information on the precedent, because I really do not think the function of this committee is to be the appellate court beyond the courts, and it would be really changing the role of the claims committee for us to go back to anything, let alone something that's as old as 1994, to reconsider a judgment that had been made in a formal court of law. We tend to deal with the cases, Mr. Cross, that don't fit within those parameters.
I understand that, and I interrupted you. I do apologize.
Okay. I'm just identifying you for the record so that Kate knows who's talking.
And I do appreciate even being heard. In all honesty, since we were told that we couldn't do anything basically at the time of the accident, now this has come up, I would rather be here now asking the question if there's anything we can do than sitting wondering for the rest of my life that we should have asked. That's why it took this long to have happen. And whether or not the Iron Range comes, you know, whether our lawyers screwed up or not, we were told so many different things along the lines. But we're here now. I mean, we were even told that there was no way that we tried for a change of venue to St. Paul and did not get it. It was taken back up to the Iron Range. And we were even told by our lawyers that the jury would not go against the Iron Range up there. But that is completely hearsay. But what it comes down to is we're here now. And obviously there's questions that are arising in your minds, because otherwise – you would have stopped it a long time ago.
And Mr. Cross, if you'd like to.
My name is Steve Cross.
Please,
again. I would only say Representative Loeffler is right. This is not a court of law. I would say, for one thing, we are very glad that it's not a court of law, because all the way along, we've gotten lots of reasons and rationales why the courts of law won't do anything. In just earlier today, you were talking about here about why you are here to do equity, and you're not bound by the rules of law. You're not an appellate court. It's right. But what we're asking for is some justice here. And we're also looking for not just getting his medical bills paid, but he's going to be in a wheelchair for life. We've got lifetime damages and lifetime costs that still aren't being paid. And that ways of paying it have to be found. There's no doubt that the state of Minnesota and its instrumentalities and people are responsible for what happened. And if you inquire into it, you will find out at least one of the stories why the verdict was what it was. You can write a novel about what all happened on this. But what we're asking here is about continuing, ongoing damages that still are being suffered, and ongoing costs that still are being incurred. And I would welcome you to postpone this and look into it, not just for the Department of Administration's position on this, but to get a full investigation of what happened in all of this, and perhaps see that something more than what courts of law think is justice is needs to be done in this case.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, I look forward to whatever additional information the department submits, or Mr. Cross and his family choose to submit before we revisit this. This wasn't a judge making a decision based on a statute that we think might have been unfair, an unfair statute in place or anything like this. This was a jury that made a decision regarding negligence. And, you know, whatever went into the jury's decision, whether it was a matter of being hometown because venue was moved, or whether it was a matter of something else more nefarious going on.
Mr. Olson?
That's not the role of this committee to investigate, and I would never support moving this committee into being sort of a super investigatory agency to second-guess jury verdicts. And that's the part that I've got the most trouble with. Mr. Cross, you stated there was no doubt that the state and its instrumentalities was responsible for this, or negligent for this, but the jury found otherwise. I'm loath to second-guess the jury. If there's some information I'm missing here, I'm certainly open to incorporating that into my analysis. I don't see how we go anywhere there. Or we, in fact, as Representative Loeffler said, we'd be opening ourselves up to every claimant against the state that lost the jury verdict, whether they had a high-low agreement beforehand or not. Position of second-guessing every jury verdict on a personal injury case against the state in Minnesota, and that's exactly what we'd be inviting. And I'm not sure. You can conclude whatever you want from what your lawyers had to say. I see the high-low agreement was a $100,000, $10,000 agreement. I assume the $100,000 back in 1994 was the tort claim limit. An agency involved. As recently as last August, or a year ago, almost 1 year ago, the limit was $300,000, so it probably was $100,000 back in the early 90s. So then we get into that whole question as well. So anyway, those are my thoughts on it based on the record that we have now. I'm certainly open, as I'm saying, to receiving more information from the claimant and his family, as well as from the department, whoever is going to respond on behalf of the Department of Administration.
Sorry, Anne.
I'm sorry. By the way, I do not begrudge at all the fact that you brought the claim here today. I think that's perfectly appropriate. I'm glad that you did, to give us an opportunity to sort through some of these issues. So
I'd like
don't feel like you're wasting your time or our time by coming here and making this presentation at all. I'm perfectly open to you having done that. I appreciate you coming forward with it.
I'd like to echo that, Mr. Cross. Because this is the type of question that we knew that was going to be coming at some point in time. And after the decisions of the bridge. So it'll be up to the committee to get some direction to the rest of the legislature on this issue.
Senator Ian? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Cross, I also wanted just to express my concurrence with the sentiment Senator Latz had raised. I was thinking along those same lines as well and wanted just to acknowledge that. But also, too, you made a statement that your understanding was that this committee is not bound by law, and I'm not sure I would agree with that. And I certainly would not want the record to reflect that we think that this committee operates above or extra legally. We are, I think, bound by statutes and precedent and law, and we try to do what we do with view to that. And also, if there is latitude within the statute to allow for judgments to be made that might be at variance with what has happened, and we're willing to entertain that. But all that notwithstanding, I think you have every right to be here to make an appearance, and we appreciate your doing so. I think it may be helpful for us to address these issues and to do so as a way of clarifying for the public what our role is as a claims committee. And so I appreciate that. But I wanted mostly just to acknowledge that Senator Latz's sentiments I concur with.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, the hearing claim is laid open. And counsel?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and is Mr. Olson on the telephone? The next case, I believe, is Vernon Olson. It is a Department of Corrections claim, and I think Mr. Hartnett is coming up.
And we have Mr. Olson on the phone.
And Mr. Olson is on the phone. So for Mr. Olson, as well as the tape, this is Michelle Timmons, Advisor of Statutes, and I'm serving as the counsel to the committee today in the absence of Mr. Lindeke. This is an appeal by Mr. Olson from this committee's July 16th of 2008 denial of his claim for personal injury. For personal injury while attempting to lift a floor buffer up the stairs. And I believe there is a little bit of additional information in terms of a letter from Mr. Olson. And then the committee staff just this morning received an additional affidavit from Alani Sylvester Branch. And I believe that one-page affidavit is in your supplementary packet.
Okay, Mr.
Arden. Mr. Chair, I haven't gotten the affidavit from Mr. Branch, so I don't know how to respond to that.
Perhaps the staff can get that document to Mr. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a procedural question?
Senator Latz.
Perhaps counsel can explain to me what exactly an appeal is from a previous decision denying a claim.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, I think we're fairly informal here. Maybe it's more properly couched as a request for reconsideration, which I think you have had several of those before you in the past. Certainly, though, the committee does not need to hear this if the committee so chooses.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Could I also ask just maybe of counsel the document you referred to, the affidavit, is it an important matter that it has not been notarized? Does that raise any questions as to its validity or not? I'm not an attorney, so.
Ms. Timmons.
I'm just asking.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Han, I would say that the process of notarization is. I would say is not as prevalent as it once used to be, particularly with the many electronic documents. Though since the inmate is not here to actually testify in person and be put under oath, the notary and having it be a sworn statement under oath would certainly be helpful. But I guess you raise a good point, but the committee can use this as evidence and give it whatever weight the committee deems appropriate.
Is Mr. Olson on the line?
Mr.
Yes.
Olson?
Mr. Olson, can you tell us as to why you are making, coming back to the committee, or what evidence, new evidence, or that you want to present before us?
Well, I got out of prison on June 24th. I had no idea that they were going to even have a hearing. I was in contact with the DOC lawyer, and nobody ever said nothing about July 16th. Oh, there was going to be a hearing. And I kind of felt like it was kind of rushed through. So when I found out that it had been decided, and then I listened to it online, it was completely infactual. So I prepared what I don't know if you've seen what I sent down there. And that's the way it happened. So I'm asking for reconsideration because to me that this should be the first time being there, as far as I'm concerned.
And what is the corrections that you'd like to put on the record? What are the corrections?
I sent that down there. Can I explain first? Right now, I had a test in the hospital on my heart on December 24th. They injected a radioactive contrast into my system. It caused an allergic reaction and kicked up at my asthma really bad. I've been up for 5 days. I've been really sick, so I'm just like in a cloud right now. But I sent down a piece of paper, a set of documents, I'll call them, and I swear to their truth and the factuality and the truth of them.
Mr. Olson,
seen those?
Mr. Olson, would you prefer to meet before the committee in person? Because we can just, there's no action going to be taken by the legislature for a period of time. They just go into session in January, but don't really conclude until April, May. And I would, you could maybe, if we postpone this issue at this time and wait until you're in better health and can come before the committee, would that be your first choice?
Well, I couldn't have made it down there to the committee today anyway. I don't have a car right now. I don't have I couldn't find anybody to take me down there. And I thought I would like to have been there, but I thought this. I was hoping I could appear by the internet or something on the computer, but or like a video conference type thing. I thought would have been a little bit better than this telephone. But
so you're comfortable with what we're doing.
Well, yes, I'm comfortable. As long as it's favorable to me, I'm comfortable.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I can interject, I think that Mr. Olson's request that the subcommittee take another look at this is entirely appropriate, and I would support subcommittee reopening this. Initially, when this case came to our office at Central Office, we had been told that there was no – excuse me.
Why don't we, based upon that recommendation, maybe we see if the people would like to have a motion to actually put this before, seeing it was denied at one time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
I'll move to reopen or reconsider the Vernon Olson matter.
Okay, any discussion on that motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The Olson claim is before us.
Mr. Chair, Randy Hartnett, Legal Services at the Department of Corrections. Initially, when I received this claim from the facility, Mr. Olson had reported that he had injured himself a year prior to the date that he filed the claim. The facility at that time went back into the records for that year and could find no evidence that at the time he had talked about this buffer incident at, you know, contemporaneously. He did mention the buffer at times after that. And on the basis of the information that we had received, that did not place Mr. Olson in that job position at the time, I made a recommendation to the subcommittee that the claim be denied, which the subcommittee agreed to. And that occurred in the March meeting. And, of course, the notice of committee's actions goes out at the end of session, as you're aware. It didn't occur in July. It occurred in March. When Mr. Olson sent in his letter to the subcommittee, I received a copy of it, and at that point I pulled his entire medical record and found that rather than his making a mention of lifting this buffer occurring a year prior to the time he filed this claim, it did occur 22 months prior to that. And so at that point, obviously, there was something that was at least within a month or two of when he alleges that this thing occurred. So, you know, what I did at that point is to prepare the packet that I assume that you have before you now. The original packet was about this thick, and this packet, because it contains substantially more medical records, is that I submitted on the 21st of November. Now, obviously, when we're trying to assess whether or not one of our prisoner claims under 3.738 occurs, there are two elements. The first element is, did the individual sustain an injury as the result of assigned duty? That was unclear because at the time there was no report of an injury having occurred made to the security staff. He did mention approximately a month later when talking to the doctor that he had injured himself lifting a buffer. When Mr. Olson submitted his letter, he mentioned that I had not contacted Mr. Branch, who was the individual whose name appears on the affidavit. It is not usually my practice to contact other offenders related to these things, but at that point I learned that Mr. Branch had been released from prison, and I asked his parole officer to speak with him about this episode, and Mr. Branch at that time told his parole officer, again, hearsay, because the parole officer was the one who contacted me, that while he remembered Mr. Olson, he didn't remember anything about a buffer. I put that in my report. Now, Mr. Olson presents this document here, which purports to be an affidavit to the contrary from Mr. Branch. Whether that's Mr. Branch's signature on there or not, I don't know. But
that is Mr. Branch's signature.
The question in my mind, is it clear that Mr. Olson has problems with his hip? Yes, it is. It is also clear that he has had fairly strong problems with his back for many years. And those problems with his back have manifested themselves in the past with pain radiating into the hip. Now, does that mean that, first of all, did he lift a buffer or not? I don't know. I presented the evidence to the subcommittee as I had it at the time. And secondly, if he did so, is the pain he's currently having the result of that episode, or was it the result of his back problems that he had for 10 years prior to this? I don't know the answer to that either. I think the subcommittee can make a decision as to the first element. The second element, I would suggest, probably is best left to an orthopedist.
Senator Lance.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hartman, do you know whether it was, in fact, the practice in the facility at the time to ask other inmates for assistance in moving equipment if they're passing,
in the stairwell. I mean, it seems to me it's just ludicrous to be moving heavy equipment in a stairwell anyway. I mean, he's just begging for claims. In any case, it was Mr. Branch's statement anyway that it was routine. If there were other inmates in the stairwell and they needed help getting equipment up or down, they simply asked for help. In addition, of course, it's the claimant's position that he was instructed to go offer to help so he could learn some of the duties that were involved. Is there any dispute about those facts here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, there is a dispute about that in that if you look at, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to look at, it's probably in the first packet, but the security staff that was in charge of supervising the swampers, now swampers is a prison term for people who clean up the living unit that they're living in. Is that correct, Mr. Olson?
Yeah, yes, that's a term they use. It's swamper is the number one person between the officer and the inmates.
So what that, and I'm here we are, it's Brenda Ramsey, she said she did not remember Mr. Olson complaining. She did remember him complaining about back pain from time to time, but had not remembered him complaining about his hip. And her questions were, why was he performing unauthorized work and why was the elevator not used? So getting back to your question, Senator Latz, as to whether it was the policy for them to carry such equipment up and down the stairs, I don't think it was the policy. Whether it was occurring or not, I don't know. Ms. Ramsey seems to say that if it had been occurring, it was not supposed to be occurring.
And Mr. Olson?
Mr. Olson? Please wait until you recognize you.
Mistakes, so I'd like to correct you as you're
Mr.
going.
Olson?
Mr. Olson?
Please wait until you're. We'll give you an opportunity here if you just wait, please.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Hartman, there's one other piece of that question which you did not address, which was Mr. Olson instructed to assist Mr. Branch so that he could learn the work that was going to be done?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I don't know. Mr. Olson says that he was, or at least Mr. Branch is saying this. There's because this occurred almost 2 years prior to when the claim occurred, I don't know that there's any documentation of that. Ms. Ramsey, her thought on here is that apparently that the elevator should have been used.
Yeah, but separate from that question, even if the official policy is the elevator should be used, if the practice is it takes too long for people to get their jobs done and they've been using the stairwells and basically everyone kind of knew that was going on anyway, then I'm prepared to set that question aside for the moment. But
right. I don't know the answer.
One question I have is whether Mr. Olson was, in fact, whether the state acknowledges that Mr. Olson was directed to go do this kind of work or whether they think Mr. Olson was just voluntarily deciding to help out and learn this job duty or whatever the case.
Well, it's my understanding, Senator Latz, that he was a swamper at about this time.
Oh.
So if that's the case, he would have been part of his job would have been buffing the floor that he was assigned to be the swamper for.
Okay. Presumably getting the equipment to that floor?
Well, there was supposedly equipment on both floors. But on the other hand, I've also heard Mr. Olson saying that the buffer was not in order on one of the floors, but each floor was supposed to have its own buffer.
So we know at least that he was a swamper at the time,
mm-hmm.
and that buffing anyway would have been among his assigned duties, right?
Buffing would have been amongst his assigned duties. The staff said that waxing and stripping the floors with the buffing that goes along with that happened twice a year, I believe. Not during this time. Mr. Olson says that the floor buffers were used to finish the floors regularly. I can only go to my own experience in that when I used to buff floors myself, we did use the buffer more than just waxing day.
Okay. And then there's some question about whether or not was there broken equipment or not. And
I don't know the answer to that.
Is there any doubt that there was a buffer that was in the stairwell being moved to a floor for use as a buffer?
There is no evidence one way or the other on that, Senator.
Well,
other than Mr. Olson's statement.
Mr.
Branch's. Well, Mr. Branch's initial statement is he recalled nothing about this. Although he says in this, I looked it over quickly, he said he was confused and there was another Mr. Olson he was thinking of.
Mr. Branch, in the new affidavit anyway, is stating that he was moving a buffer up a stairwell in order to use it in connection with Mr. Branch's duties, and that Mr. Olson's duties would have included the kind of work that the buffer was intended to be used for.
That's certainly plausible.
And Arnica, is your recommendation still denial?
Mr. Chair, no, my recommendation is not denial. I think that the question is that, you know, up until Mr. Branch's purported affidavit arrived here, it appeared that there were two different stories about what happened, or three different stories, I guess, if you count the fact that the supervisor said that that ought not to have happened. Now, you know, whether it occurred or not, you know, I don't know that for sure. Certainly, Mr. Olson has maintained that all along. And in this document, Mr. Branch is apparently saying that now, too, which is inconsistent with what he told his parole officer originally.
Can I object?
Just wait a minute.
Okay.
There's,
I have the right to object.
Just wait a minute. We're not in a trial. This is a committee hearing. What is your recommendation, though?
I don't know the answer to whether or not this occurred. And at this point, I mean, assuming that if the committee is willing to accept this document as having come from Mr. Branch, that puts it in a different light. But in this case, you know, it's Mr. Branch signs it and says he didn't have time to have it notarized. I don't know whether that.
Okay. Right. So you don't have a recommendation.
It appears to me that certainly the information that I had to begin with that suggested very strongly that this didn't occur has been eroded by the fact that it apparently occurred almost a year earlier than was originally thought.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hamm.
Just one other question here, and I want to try to get clarification. Senator Latz, Mr. Hart, was asking you about just the facts as the department knows them, and it seems to me an important component to understand whether or not he was asked to do this work. And I guess I'm trying to understand what your position is. Is it your position that moving this buffer was – he claims he was directly asked by staff to do this. And I guess I'm trying to understand whether you're disputing that or acknowledging that or – what is the position?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn. I can neither dispute it nor acknowledge it. The staff has no recollection of that order being made. Mr. Olson, however, says that it had been, and I'd have to look at Mr. Branch's document here, but I'm assuming that to see whether it mentions whether or not he was ordered to do it or not.
And Mr. Arnold, the document that is called the affidavit, he says that Mr. Olson told him that Officer Ramsey had told him. So he's reporting what Mr. Olson reported.
Right. I have no reason to doubt Officer Ramsey's memo in which she said, why wasn't the elevator used?
So I guess my conclusion would be is that you might, the Department of the State might take some issue with the claim that he was directed to do this specific task. Is that correct?
Well, it's certainly, again, the passage of time, but Officer Ramsey asked why anybody was doing this work being unauthorized work, and secondly, why the elevator was not used. So from there, I would have to take it that Officer Ramsey's position was that she did not order them this to occur.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson, you
yes,
had
sir.
It appears as though the document that Mr. Branch has provided is not notarized, and so that is kind of coming in question. Can you get this a notarized document?
He was notarized. He called me. He works. He drives cab at night.
Okay.
And when I finally did get a hold of him, get his number and everything, well, by the time he did that affidavit, it was a couple days before Christmas. And I said, well, it's got to be over there by Monday. And he said, well, he works at nights. And I said, well, just sign it. And I said, put your phone number and stuff on there. And I said, that if that's not good enough, he is willing to swear to it and have it notarized. I'm sure of that. So I thought that would be good enough.
It appears as though that this piece of information or affidavit is very important in the decision-making process. And so if you can get a notarized affidavit to us, that would be appreciated, and then the committee could take up this issue at a future time.
Okay.
And I think that would probably be the best route for us to go, unless there's objection from committee members. Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, since we did allow Mr. Hartnett to kind of answer questions, and Mr. Olson did want to respond to that, I think we should at least let him respond to what we heard in the record today, even if we're going to lay it over.
Okay, Mr. Olson, if you'd like to respond, and then we're going to lay the claim over while you get, giving you time to get a notarized affidavit to us.
Okay. I would just like to run through quickly and just correct a couple things. I'll make this quick.
Okay.
When I first, well, let's start with was I doing my job or not. I was actually assigned unit buffer when I hurt my hip. That was my job. Mr. Brandt was going to teach me how to buff the floors. Miss Ramsey's direct order was to help Mr. Brandt and learn how to buff the floors because I was going to be a unit buffer. So that's when I went. Mr. Branch had the stairway blocked with the buffer, and I said, well, do you want me to help you get it up there? And he said, hey, I'm not sure if he asked me first, but I grabbed it, and that's when it happened. So that's the first thing, was I performing my job or not? And officers don't follow you around and order you to do everything you do. They pride them. They look for people that can are self-starters, that can work on their own, and people they can trust. So that's, I'm sure, and Miss Ramsey, all of Miss Ramsey's testimony that you just used is all second and third hearsay. Coming from the first investigation, I think it's come through about three or four people. Now, you know, if Mrs. Ramsey was here, I'm sure you'd hear a different statement from her, or she would back up what I've said. And so when I first heard it, I went to the doctor a week later, not a month, as Mr. Hartnett said, and I reported it to the doctor. And I worked with the doctor for 18 months with conservative therapy, and I thought, well, why won't this get better? It just keeps getting worse and worse. I was working with restrictions. And at the time the year came in, I had asked for time off to let my hip heal. I was directed to work, or I would be sent to a maximum security institution. So that's a working institution. So that was as far as getting the time off, that's as far as that went. And then I saw the doctor regularly about my hip and other things, and not until I learned, and it was about 18 months, did I learn when he said I had permanent damage that was irreversible. That is the point I started the claim process. And I think my medical records back up that I tried to work with this. I tried to work through it. My intent was not to file a claim against the Department of Corrections, believe me. But also, I should not, for performing my job duties, I should have some kind of protection. And when I had requested the claim form, I had written on there I had hurt myself about a year ago. So I think that's maybe where that year came from, when it had been actually about 18 months. 22 months, I think that's from the time I got out of prison. That's, I don't know, that's probably from the time I hurt my hip to the time I got out of prison was probably 22 months. But let's see, what else? Well, again, Ms. Ramsey, all Ms. Ramsey's testimony that you've heard today is all at least third hearsay. And let's see, anything else? I couldn't, it would have been nice if I could have objected on the way through, because there were a few other things that were erroneous. But I performed my job to the best of my ability, even to my own detriment. A swamper is a key person between the inmates and the officers. They like to know what's going on the unit. Well, that puts the swamper in a very tedious position. If inmates think he's snitching, they beat the hell out of him like they did to me. And if you're not working hard enough, then the officer gets on you. So it's really, it's a tough position to do a good job in. And I performed my job to the best of my ability. That's all I got to say on that. And not until I learned I had permanent damage did I file for protection of my rights. And that's exactly what I filed. Filed to have my rights protected. The doctor told me I would need hip surgery within 5 years. That was the DOC doctor. And that's when I filed the claim, because I didn't know if I'd have insurance or what. And I can't afford a hip surgery. And that should not be the punishment. That should not be the punishment of going to prison. I did ask for time off to let my hip heal. They would not give me time off. I was forced to work through it, and then I did my best. I don't know what else I can say. I can, Mr. Branch, I'm sure, will notarize that, and I can get that. I'll call him tonight. And it was my fault for the notary thing. Because I thought, rather than have it arrive there late and be notarized, it was better to have it arrive there with his signature and stuff on it. That's why I directed him to do that. I said, I guess I should have told him to get it notarized. You can, I guess, get, that's about all I got to say.
Okay. If you can send that to us, and we're going to lay this over, and when it comes up before another hearing in the future, you'll be notified.
Okay, how long do you think that'll be, sir? It's already been like over 2 years. It's already been a couple of years.
Well, this is you're into a legislative process. Legislature starts in January, and they have to be completed towards the end of April, middle of May. So
should I prepare more testimony from the witnesses like Ms. Ramsey and maybe the DOC doctor? Should I look for affidavits from them?
Whatever you can provide to substantiate your claim is in your interest.
Well, is there any way I can compel that testimony? Because I'm not sure the DOC will allow them to make a statement on my behalf, unless you can order it.
We have no way of doing that.
Well...
Okay, is there any other questions?
If you're going to use their testimony, I would ask that you use their testimony and not third hearsay of their testimony. That's all I would ask of the committee. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Latz.
Counsel asked whether or not there was any value in having any kind of a an evaluation of the... the extent to which the injury would be compensable if we were to determine, I guess the proper terminology is a rateable permanent impairment. If we were to determine that there was work-related causation, I don't know that I want to put the department to an extraordinary expense in that process, but would it perhaps make sense? I'll ask Mr. Hartnett if he thinks it might make sense for purposes of moving this process along in the interim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, that was actually going to be my next question before Mr. Olson hung up the phone, was whether or not you wanted me to try and arrange for independent medical exam. That's something that does take some time because we need to do a contract. Typically, one of these exams is going to run between $1,500 to $2,500, and that's why I had asked the subcommittee whether or not they wanted us to do that. If
I've already had the one exam.
What complicates this more, of course, is that Mr. Olson already had degenerative disease in that area prior to this incident that he says occurred. So whether or not there's a contribution from that or not, I don't know. I do know that there was some sort of a radiographic report that indicated he had degeneration in his hip.
If for purposes of argument, Mr. Chairman,
by a specialist orthopedic surgeon,
Mr. Olson, Mr. Chairman, for purposes of argument, if we were to assume that this was a work-related, at least there's some evidence from which one might conclude that this is a work-related injury. We would need to go through an evaluation to determine how to handle any award as a result. The amount of the claim not being specified and there being some question as to what extent any pre-existing conditions might have contributed to the current physical condition, it's something which would take some time, for which we would need an IME before we made any decisions, and I'm not sure I'd want to be under the pressure as we get toward the middle or the end of session to force a decision on this either. In Mr. Olson's interest, certainly, and I think in this committee's interest, if we can reach a conclusion about this before the end of the upcoming legislative session. So I think it might make some sense to go forward with an IME, even though there's some expense to the state here, in the scheme of this process, I think that might be a worthwhile expense, so that we can have a sense of the total claim before us when we next hear it. I'm just one member of the committee. I'd be interested if there are others that feel the same way. It's not inexpensive, but it's...
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz may be one member of the committee, but he's got a lot of experience in this area, so I appreciate him sharing a process to go through. So I would endorse that, too.
Mr. Olson, would you be willing to cooperate with the department in getting further examinations to get us the information we need to make a decision?
Yes, sir. I'd be fully cooperative.
Mr. Olson, where are you living now?
I live in 3143 Lilac Street, Pine River, Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you.
Cold cities would be Brainerd. Brainerd would be nice if you can find a doctor in Brainerd.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Olson, you understand that to the extent we make any award, if we were to get to that point, that it would only be in connection with what the committee were to determine were the extent of your permanent injury caused by that particular incident not compensable for any other pre-existing conditions that have contributed to your condition.
Yes, I fully understand that, and there was X-rays taken of my hip like 6 months prior to the incident, and they were clear and negative, and I even had MRIs even a couple years before that, and all those have came up clear. So in relationship to like my back, they look at the hips and stuff too. So
One other thing, Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested in, I know normally we rely on the department to kind of present the information from individuals that work within the institutions on their behalf. Mr. Olson has expressed a confidence that Ms. Ramsey would support his position, which seems a bit at odds with information that we are told Ms. Ramsey is providing directly to the department's representative. I don't know what authority, if any, we have to ask Ms. Ramsey to participate directly in the proceeding if the committee is interested in hearing directly from her. But it sounds like there might be easier as essentially a trier of fact, which is what the members of the committee are in this case, to hear directly from a witness whose testimony is in substantial dispute. If there's any way the department could secure her participation or some kind of written statement from her, or allow Mr. Olson to have an opportunity to communicate with her so that he can share, if this were a trial, we certainly would have that.
Yes.
It's not exactly a trial, but we're kind of in that position.
Senator Latz, just from a historical perspective, I have been at committee hearings where we've directed the Department of Natural Resources to have certain officers be here in order to be able to give testimony directly to the committee. So we do have that type of ability. So a state employee can be directed through the department to come before the committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, certainly whatever the subcommittee's pleasure is, I don't know what Ms. Ramsey's schedule is, et cetera. We could go by way of an affidavit if the subcommittee had questions they wanted to form, or Mr. Olson could submit, or we could ask if Ms. Ramsey could attend a subcommittee meeting.
I'd like it if she could attend.
So would I, if that's possible. It's really hard to do. Mr. Olson clearly has some questions that he thinks Ms. Ramsey would support, and it's really difficult to ask Mr. Olson to question her, I guess, or to elicit the information he's hoping to elicit without having some direct opportunity to talk with her.
My concern, Senator Latz, is that this process is supposed to be a process that is aside from the judicial process, and we get to the point where we have witnesses and then cross-examination, et cetera. At some point, the process becomes enormously complicated, and I suspect I could probably line up a number of offenders who, if they disagree with what the staff has reported in an email, such as we have here, would be happy to have that staff take off from work and come down here so that they could cross-examine them.
That's a fair point. Sure I want to become a trial court.
Senator Hand. Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm certainly open to having Officer Ramsey come and visit with us and testify. I'm not certain that it's needed. I understand there is some conflict, and it may be helpful if she would just address those specific points in a statement. First in my mind is whether or not she directed Mr. Olson to carry the buffer up the stairs, as he suggests that she did.
Well, no, she directed me to assist Mr. Branch.
Okay. And maybe might be useful to have her clarify what that meant. She does say in a memo that it looks like on page, I guess it's Exhibit G in this packet, that where she's saying she has questions about why he was performing unauthorized work and why he didn't use the elevator. No, Mr. Olson said that directive emerged after the fact, and I guess I would want clarification on that point. When was the standing directive to use the elevator to move buffers in place? Was that before or after the actual incident that occurred? But I don't know that it would be absolutely necessary. I just think that there had to be some clarification as to what her direction was to Mr. Olson and I guess, and also the elevator issue.
That right, and certainly this case is certainly hobbled by the fact that the facts, the claim was raised, as Mr. Olson says, 18 months. I think it probably is closer to 22 months by my count, after the alleged incident took place. A lot of things have happened in that period of time. So.
Yeah. Well, we do our best.
Any other questions, members? Okay, Mr. Olson will give you a notification as to when the next committee meeting will be, and if you get that affidavit to us, that'd be appreciated.
Yes, sir. I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay. The Olson committee or the Olson claim is laid over. All right.
Chair.
Mr. Olson.
I could make these property claims go pretty quick.
Okay.
I would make a motion to deny 1 through
40 except for 7, 11, 12, and 20.
Okay, Senator Olsen moves that on the agenda dated Monday, December 29th, 1 p.m., under property claims against Department of Corrections, under property claims, that all the claims are denied except for 7, 11, 12, and 20.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hand.
Just a question for Senator Olsen. Could he review for us the rationale for choosing the ones he did for us to have further examination of?
I certainly can, and that is exactly why, for further examination. Some of them, Mr. Lenneke had questions on in his comments, and some I had a question on myself. I think it was number 11. I had a question I'd like to ask.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olsen, just to be clear, the ones that you're asking or suggesting that we take up are ones where counsel has indicated that we should hear in some detail, and the others are all recommendations that he's giving us to deny.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, in light of the testimony by the Department of Human Services, if the subcommittee would indulge me, I wanted to do a little bit of clarification as to how the Department of Corrections looks at these property claims. If the subcommittee, Ms.
Do you want us to do that before we make the?
It will be brief. Okay. I'm sorry. Why don't you go ahead and make that vote? I'm sorry.
We were just going to, unless there's a. You have additional information on items?
Not about these specific cases, no, sir.
Okay. We have a motion before us, Senator Olsen's. Senator Letts.
All right, Mr. Chairman, could we also pull out number 22?
Senator Olsen?
That'd be fine.
Okay. Is there a recommendation on 21?
Any others?
And maybe also Mr. 20, number 21, Mr. Chairman. I didn't see. Oh, there's the recommendations in the middle.
Yeah, it's in the middle. It is to deny in that one.
No, we don't need to pull that.
Okay. So the motion be to deny all except for 7, 11, 12, 20, and 22. Further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Those claims are denied. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I agree with counsel for the Department of Human Services that the Minnesota Tort Claims Act precludes loss related to loss of property for inmates of state correctional or medical institutions. Our claim process, as you're aware, has been going on certainly longer than 14 years because I came into it, and the process is essentially the same as it was 14 years ago when I started. That we do review the claims with an eye towards determining whether or not there was an act or omission of a state employee that resulted in the loss. The claims that you have before you are those claims that we determined that there wasn't in our estimation, there was no act or omission of a state employee, or at least there wasn't sufficient evidence of that act or omission so that the claim had to be paid. You should be aware that we pay an enormous number of property claims. We have 10,000 offenders in 8 different adult male institutions. They get moved around. They have lots and lots of property, even though they're in prison. And the longer they stay there, the more property that they accumulate. And as we all know from our personal lives, things happen. Ms. Lind put together statistics, and of I believe it was 65 claims were paid that were submitted. Those don't come to the subcommittee because we pay them. The total amount paid was $6,600. So the claims that we do have before you, in contrast to what I was getting from the Department of Human Services, we don't take the position that the statute precludes us from paying claims. Our position is that the statute precludes us from paying claims where there was no act or omission of a state employee that resulted in the loss. And that's what we have here today, is those particular claims.
I appreciate that clarification, because I get a little frustrated with the changes the department has taken recently, and so I think that getting some of your rationale actually maybe established in some of the language somewhere along the line may be helpful.
Well, Mr. Chair, understand that if an offender were to take a property claim to court, our position would be that it's precluded by this Tort Claims Act. And as a matter of fact, that has occurred. And in a couple of isolated incidences, the judge didn't accept the fact that the statute precluded that and made a small claims judgment against the department. But very typically, when the offenders take the matter to a small claims court, the matter is dismissed because of the statute in that language.
And, counsel, would you like us to start off with
Number seven, the first one to be considered under the property grouping here is Dylan Frone, who claims that the light socket of his lamp was damaged. And Mr. Lindeke wrote a fairly long note on this one, indicating that while the lamp is a minor item, but he clearly states that the socket was broken when he unpacked the boxes. It must not have been broken when the boxes were packed. It would have been confiscated. It doesn't seem the receiving property people at Faribault saw the lamp, and indication is that he signed for the property but opened it later, which is common. So he wrote, Mr. Lindeke wrote a note that this just doesn't seem so open and shut as indicated in the partner letter. So that is why it was pulled out.
Okay, comments?
Nicole Lynn, Department of Corrections. The only thing, when I talked to Craig, I just told him that I still stand by my recommendation to deny it, because all offenders at Faribault have the opportunity to go through their boxes and check their property. And he signed the inventory form acknowledging that everything was in working order. Went back to his cell and then later claimed that it was broken.
Mr. Chair?
Earl Seen.
Do you have an idea what the time frame was between when he signed the inventory and when he filed that it was damaged? Was it like couple hours or a couple days?
I don't think it was that long, Senator
Olsen, Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen. I did glance through this earlier this morning, and it was my impression that Mr. Frond told the claims officer that he told a property staff member the following day that his lamp was broken, but did not know which claim, which person it was, so the claims officer wasn't able to follow up on that, and then subsequently filed his claim approximately a week later, or 13 days later, I guess is what it was.
So, Mr. Chair, is the thought that he could have damaged it himself then, and is just filing for this claim? Because it does seem that if it was packed up, the note in there, I think I read that if it would have been damaged when it was packed up, they would have noticed that and would have been confiscated.
Correct.
So somehow, between the shipment and a week later, it was damaged. So the question is, was it damaged in shipment, or was it damaged when he's setting up his cell?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, that's why we ask the offenders to sign for the property when they receive it after shipment. Do things get damaged in shipping? Yes, they do. And our staff are trained to look at what's obvious. They turn TVs on when they get them, and that's
You know, was it, you know, is it something that if they had noticed it, would they have not given it to him? Generally, that is the case. Now, when it got broken is the question. Did it get broken during shipping? Did it get broken after he had received it and went back to his room? We don't know the answer to that because he signed for it as being having been in, intact when he received the property.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to, on that point, is there opportunity for people to examine? I'm assuming they're getting a box with property in it, then they sign for it. I know we had a case a while back that involved what was the steps involved in signing and acknowledging that something happened before you had a, really a chance to verify that that was, in fact, the case. In other words, if they're handed over a box and say, here, sign that you've got everything and everything's okay, and they have to sign for it before they look at it, then it seems to me a, sort of a useless exercise. But if they're given an opportunity before they take receipt to acknowledge that they have things, can you describe a little more completely what that process is?
Senator Hahn, the process is that they are supposed to examine the property upon receipt.
Before they sign for it?
And when they're signing, that they received it in an intact. Now, is it possible that in the rush of things, somebody maybe said, maybe be told, let's hurry up, or whatever? That's possible. Whether that occurred in this particular case, that would be against our policy and our normal procedure, because that's the reason we go through the if we didn't want them to check their belongings, we wouldn't have the inventory in the first place. I've talked with the property staff for the last 14 years. We need to inventory the stuff when it comes into our possession and when it leaves our possession. Otherwise, there's ambiguity. Offenders do break things by accident. Sometimes they break things on purpose because getting the money for it is more important than having the item for whatever reason. We have to assume that if this guy signed for it, and assuming that the standard operating procedure took place.
Well, and that's what I'd like to assume, unless there are reasons to suspect or believe that inmates don't have that opportunity or are under some pressure to sign for a receipt without examining it. I mean, if the standard practice is to come in and be pressured to take your stuff and get moving, and if you say, no, I want to look at it, that there's sort of a negative repercussion that attends to that, then there might be a sort of established sort of procedure to go ahead and take things and sign for them without having examined it. And that's what I'm trying to determine. If the practice is to give people, encourage them to make sure that they're signing for their things that are intact, or whether they're being encouraged to sign for things without them.
Right. Our policy is that if they're being asked to sign for receiving something intact, that they have the chance to do that. Have offenders told us that, no, they didn't get the chance? Just about every time that we're in this situation.
Sure they do. Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Holstein.
I want to thank you guys because we got to tour the prison down in Stillwater. But following up on Senator Hahn's question, if the bus is coming in and there's 40 prisoners on there, does the gear, is it in the base of the bus or does it come by a separate truck? Because I could see where 40 people are coming in or X amount of people are coming at one time, there might be pressure to say, you know, let's move this along type of thing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I don't know specifically about this case. Sometimes it is a bus full. The property is kept underneath a bus. It's like a Greyhound bus. Our transportation department has developed a system for transporting televisions. Because televisions were something that were fairly fragile and were paying out claims for them. So I think they put the televisions in a padded box kind of situation.
With bubble wrap?
I don't know about bubble wrap. I believe there's foam rubber in the boxes. At least that's the way I've heard it described.
And the inmate's property is generally packed up in these foot lockers, which are, I don't know if you've got a chance to see those, which are stackable foot lockers. And that's the reason that they're limited to two, is we have to move people with regularity because we've got security levels in our prisons and 10,000 offenders with two foot lockers each is 20,000 foot lockers, not counting the TVs and the lamps and the legal materials and all those sorts of things.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of this payment.
Okay. Motion is made to approve, and it is the amount is $17.25?
Yes.
Okay. Is there questions on the...
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little... If he has the opportunity to examine his property and doesn't take the time to do it, then it does raise that question of when the damage actually got done. And I guess not knowing any other information otherwise, I'm assuming that he either did examine or had the opportunity to examine and either did and found it to be intact or chose not to. But in my mind, it raises a question of whether or not the damage actually occurred in transit. And so I'm not sure if I'm willing to support the motion by Senator Olsen. I mean, I know it's not a large claim, but if people have a chance to look at their stuff and validate it, then I think that's an important procedure that we ought to try to support rather than encourage it to be set aside, because I think that there probably is some cases where inmates want to damage their property intentionally and then make claim for compensation, and I don't want to encourage that necessarily either. So I just have a question in my mind about it.
Mr. Hartnett, the claim is for $12.25, and is that the reason it's listed as $17.25 is that to include the $5 return?
Mr. Chairman,
some
yeah.
of them do that, and some of them don't. Okay, so that includes the $5.
Right. Can you reimburse our filing fee if we pay the claim?
Pardon?
We reimburse our filing fee if we pay the claim.
Okay. The reason that I quickly went through to find out how many people had a $12 loss and spent $5 to try and get it back or risk $5. And if nothing else, that kind of tells me that this guy may have a legitimate claim here. I saw one other that was for $15.25, but that one didn't include the $5, so that would be $20. Anyway, the motion's before us. Any other questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
Chair's in doubt. Those in favor, raise your hands. Those opposed? Okay, motion fails.
No,
it
passed.
No.
I thought you raised your hand. I'm sorry.
I did, but it takes a prevailing... You only had one person in the Senate voting for it.
Oh.
You have to have a majority over there. Is there a motion to deny?
I'll move that it be denied.
There's a motion to deny. Any questions on that motion? All those in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no? Okay, that motion fails.
What do we do?
Another nice mess we got ourselves in. Hey, is there...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm confused if we've failed to accept the claim and we failed to deny the claim. What is the status of the claim?
Yeah. Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, since this one has some doubt, and we need to resolve this, I would make a motion that we settle the claim for $10.
Okay, there's a motion to settle the claim for $10.
Mr. Chairman, could I amend the motion to have it be a claim that he be refunded his filing fee? That be the amount.
Refund his filing fee.
I would agree with that.
I make that, and I would offer that amendment.
Is
instead of 15, it's 5.
Yep, he's just...
Okay. So it, so in other words, you're going, the motion would be, and if I'm not rewording this properly, let me know, it's to deny the claim but refund the filing fee.
Yes.
Okay, any questions on that motion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. This is $5 back.
Okay. Chairman and members, the next one, I guess number 11, is this Anthony Villebrun, which involves the loss of some Nike tennis shoes, which became bloody due to an altercation in which the inmate was stabbed, and so they were a biohazard and were disposed of, and I think Mr. Lindeke did recommend a denial, and but I believe Senator Olsen had a question on it.
Yeah, and it just brought up a question for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think he started the altercation, so my question is, if somebody's damaged or their property is damaged like that, does the other prisoner pay for his shoes, or is this guy out his shoes because somebody started a fight with him?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, when an individual is accused of violating an inmate disciplinary regulation, if it's a serious matter, they go before a hearing officer, and that hearing officer does have the power to assess restitution. Now, I suspect it probably didn't happen in this case. It's my understanding that the individual got a year and 3 months segregation, which is a very stiff segregation sentence. Probably was referred to the county attorney's office for a first-degree assault charge. I don't know whether or not that had occurred. It's sometimes difficult to get the county attorneys to prosecute things that happen in our facilities. But I don't know that there was a restitution order from the hearing officer in this particular case. I suspect that the issue of the victim's shoes was nowhere on the hearing officer's radar.
Mr. Chair, that's why I questioned this one. Because it seemed to me that it wasn't the guy's fault. That I don't believe, obviously, he's not the guy in SAG, so he's not the one that started the altercation. And so he's out his shoes. So I guess I would make a motion that we pay for the shoes.
Well, there's a motion on the table. Any discussion on the motion? Representative Laughlin?
Mr. Chair, I do think there should be restitution in this case. I mean, that's the preferable solution to this, but I don't know if when someone's committed to segregation, are they even allowed to work and earn resources to it? Do that? I mean, so it's not a reasonable option, even if it had been thought of?
Any restitution obligation is put against an offender's account, and the offender's account is held in trust for that offender. Funds that come in from family members, funds that come in from inmate jobs, all go into that account. There is a statute that says what order that is supposed to go out on. The first is, if memory serves me, orders from the court for child support, basically, and then from there comes court-ordered restitution, et cetera. Institutional restitution is about in the middle of that. So somebody in segregation doesn't work. That doesn't mean they don't necessarily have funds to pay restitution. Some of our offenders are completely indigent. Many of them are. Others have significant amounts of money. In this particular case, I simply don't have any way of knowing. Generally, I don't know the answer to this specific case, but we are very cautious about these assault cases because very frequently assaults are the result of one person who is fighting losing and the other person winning. In this case, it appears that offenders would be sent to segregation even if it was a fight, if they It's an enormously serious thing to use a pointed weapon in a prison. So even if this had been a fist fight that went bad, this gentleman would have gotten a segregation sentence of some extreme length.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hatt.
Thank you. Just a question on the confiscation of the shoes, and I don't know how much blood was on them, but why wouldn't they just have simply been cleaned up and returned to the inmate after this incident was adjudicated?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, we have a bloodborne pathogens policy that's very strict. A lot of our offenders are infected with bloodborne pathogens because of intravenous drug use. We have a number of offenders that are HIV positive, a number of them that also have hepatitis. And so rather than to try and expose either the staff or other offenders to that, anything that's contaminated with blood is our standard operating procedure to discard that and treat it as the same way a hospital would put, gets red bagged and tossed.
And so there, when that happens, there's no effort to replace the article? I mean, if a person had only one pair of shoes, for example, which I don't know, and those shoes happen to be in this circumstance, would he just then be barefoot for the rest of his term?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, an offender can come into one of our prisons wearing nothing but what they were wearing on the day they were born, and they'll be clothed and fed. Frequently, offenders just simply don't like the state-issued shoes and wear their own. Sometimes they get charged for a state issue. It depends on any number of situations. But no one would go barefoot because their shoes were lost.
Mr. Hartnett, do we know whether this claimant, was he in any way disciplined for anything in connection with this?
I don't believe so, Senator Lance.
So, Mr. Hardin, would you conclude from that he was not culpable in any way?
I would not be able to conclude he was not culpable in any way, but he was certainly not culpable in a way that the hearing officer would have been able to assign blame for that particular incident.
I certainly feel restitution is appropriate, but I'm not sure that this is the form in which it should occur.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I suspect that the issue of this individual's shoes came up well after the issue of the stabbing was reviewed. Obviously, these shoes probably sat in a bag in the evidence room for a number of weeks, and this gentleman finally said, well, where are my shoes? Well, they got tossed because they were blood contaminated. We've had a number of claims throughout the years that offenders have been involved in altercations with another offender. Sometimes they were at fault. Sometimes it was a mutual thing. Sometimes they were being restrained by staff. Because of the bloodborne pathogens policy, anything that's contaminated with blood is discarded.
Well, I understand the policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good one. It's just troubling that this person was in his shoes, but apparently no fault of his own, at least as the hearing officer made disciplinary decisions.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, is it? I agree with you, and I think it's hard for me to say, well, this is a liability that should accrue to the state or the department. That seems to me the proper restitution would be with the person, the offender, that they put in segregation as a result of the attack. Is there a way for us to ask for that to happen, or maybe ask for the state to make good on the shoes and then empower them to reimburse themselves from the offender who caused the harm in the first place? I don't know. I just think that that's where the restitution ought to come from the person who did the stabbing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, if the subcommittee would want to basically set this on the table, I can see what I can find out from the standpoint of what can happen. Obviously, the context we have to look at this in is that this particular incident is the incident we're dealing with here. It is unfortunately not the only assault that occurs in our facilities, and we have offenders stealing from other offenders with some regularity, as you folks are all well aware of. At some point, my concern would be what kind of mechanism we'd be able to do that. But I'd be happy to see, related to this particular incident, what can be done. Because I agree with you that in the way it looks here, the gentleman whose shoes got tossed was physically injured and lost his shoes.
Okay. Well, with the concurrence of the committee, why don't we lay this matter over? And ask for a report back to Mr. Hartman at our next meeting whether they've arranged for restitution. All right, the matter's laid on the table. Let's play it over.
Counsel?
Okay, yes, Mr. Chairman and members. The next matter, number 12, is a claim by Howard Lechowitzer. And there is some additional documentation on this one that was in your supplemental packet. It's a one-page memo from Ms. Lynn. Basically, this was a loss of personal items claim, property claim. And one of the particular claims rang true to Mr. Lindeke in that the claimant said that he's a size 9 and he was sent size 13 shower shoes. So clearly he did not get his shower shoes back when he returned from segregation. So Mr. Lindeke thought there was sufficient evidence that there must have been some negligence somewhere to have gotten the wrong size shoes back. And he suggested to Ms. Lynn that the department pay for those shoes, which the department did agree to do. They paid him $3.50 for the shower shoes plus the $5 filing fee for his claim. But the department recommends a denial of the remaining property claims, and I concur in that recommendation.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, yeah.
Maybe, counsel, there's another claim here for the same person. Are these at all related?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I looked at that this morning. There is a second claim by the same gentleman. It appeared to be a different claim to me. But maybe Ms. Lind has better information on that.
It is another claim.
It's another claim, and I did take a look at that, and as did Mr. Lindeke, we both recommended denial of that claim.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
I would move for denial of I can't even say that name, of the remainder of his claim.
And that would be claim identified as 139642?
I got it as number 12.
Right, it's the one on the form.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. I believe Mr. Lechowitzer, Senator Olson.
Yep. Thank you.
Mr. Lechowitzer has two claims in front of
him. Yeah, the claims are assigned a claim number. Ms. Lind has pointed out that the claim related to that where the shoes were paid was 08PR119.
Okay.
And I believe his other claim probably has a different number, I'm assuming.
Yes, it does.
That would be 08PR186.
Okay, and this motion is to 119, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, any questions on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I believe the next claim is that of Roberta Culpepper. And Mr. Lindeke did recommend the denial of this claim, but I believe it was Senator Olsen who wanted to pull this one up, and I think there is some merit in considering it because there's clear evidence that Ms. Culpepper did, in fact, order a pair of shoes from J.C. Penney and that she paid $94.95 for them. They came to the facility and they did not fit her. So then I believe that she went to the property room, somebody at the facility, and sent the shoes out back to J.C. Penney's. But J.C. Penney says they never received it. They never received the shoes back. So J.C. Penney will not give her a refund. And I guess the department's response in part was that Ms. Culpepper did not request that the shoes be mailed out with any special mail service, so there wasn't any return receipt or any proof about receipt of the shoes, so they were apparently sent by regular U.S. mail. That seems to be the best evidence that exists here. And so the claim is here, I think, because Ms. Culpepper is out $94.95 and cannot get money back from either J.C. Penney's or the post office or the Department of Corrections. And maybe the department has additional information.
Senator Latz and member, I actually don't have any additional information other than if you go to the post office and send something through the mail and don't pay for the extra charge of tracking it, then it gets lost.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Burke, Senator Lynn Han.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we accept the claim for the $94.95 that Ms. Culpepper makes, and I guess I just am reading through this, and I'm persuaded that the circumstances occurred as they're described. I don't think anyone is disputing that, and I think under these circumstances where the department has the obligation or it assumes the obligation to return the shoes, and if they fail to do it in a way that is able to be validated, then I think they have some responsibility for that. So I would move we accept the claim.
Okay, the motion was to pay the claim. A recommendation to pay the claim. Further discussion? Okay, Mr. Hartnick, any further comments?
Well, the only other comment I would make is that I'm assuming that this offender did have the chance to purchase. She was making, as I said, offenders are provided with the clothing they need. Her choice was to get better shoes, so she worked with J.C. Penney, and when they didn't fit, she was given the chance to send them out and had the chance, I think, at that point to request, because she was paying for the postage, to request special handling, chose not to do it, and as a consequence didn't have a return receipt. The evidence we have is that they were sent out in due course.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe I need to. I was under the understanding that she did not have much option in how these were to be returned, that those were turned over to the property department to return, and they made the decision on how to do that. Is that not correct?
Senator Han, Mr. Chair, she has the option. She can pick go first class mail and get a receipt and a tracking order, or she could send it out fourth class mail, which is what I was saying. You go to the post office, drop it in the box, and there you go.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to, for the time being, rescind my motion, because it may be that if she had the opportunity to do something differently and chose not to, then maybe that does become her obligation. So at this point, I'm going to think about that and just rescind my motion.
Okay. Motion is withdrawn. Further questions, members? Further motions?
I would make Senator Hahn's motion.
Take it up, okay.
Is
Senator Olsen makes a motion to pay the claim.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lass.
I've got a question. Is there any dispute as to whether or not it was mailed out by the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chair, no. There's no dispute. We did mail it out.
It looks like, Ms. Lynn, from your investigation, that Ms. Culpepper's account was deducted for shipping and handling and postage. So there seems to be a record that it was mailed out. So I'm having difficulty finding a way in which the department did anything wrong here.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, I agree with you. That was when I initially made the motion. It wasn't clear to me that the inmate had some options here to how this was to be done. But it seemed to me this would be just like if I went and returned a package by mail and it got lost and I didn't bother to send it registered mail, then I just would be, you know, a lesson learned next time, send it differently. And I guess I agree with you. I don't think that under the circumstances the department did as they were directed to do, and it didn't work out, and that's an unfortunate circumstance, but I think it's hard to hold the department responsible for the loss. So you've got to ask the post office to make good on your phone.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hartnett or Ms. Lynn, there's a copy of a letter here from J.C. Penney with some handwritten notes on it. It says 6/17/08, 11:15 a.m. U.S. Post Office in Shakopee with a phone number. Do you have any idea who wrote that?
Mr. Chair, I'm just assuming it's from J.C. Penney.
Mr. Chair, it's possible the offender may have made the phone call to the post office after receiving this letter and made those notes herself. They're not initialed. Offenders do have the capability and the right to make phone calls to the post office, et cetera.
Because that's the date and time that is written on an offender kite form, and I can't tell if it's a response. It says response from, and there's a signature, and then it was mailed out on 6/17/11:15 a.m. You'll have to call or write J.C. Penney's. So that's the same date and time that's written on that letter from J.C. Penney. So I doubt it was J.C. Penney. It looks like it's probably a staff member.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I thought you were asking who wrote this letter. From customer service representative.
Are we all looking at the outgoing property sheet? Is that what we're...
There was a letter from J.C. Penney, item number 4 in the packet.
If that was, I'm guessing that if that was item number 4, it was probably the offender probably had that piece of paper when she filed her claim. And my guess is that she was the one who wrote those notes on there. The way the inmate kites work, Senator Latz, is that the offender writes at the top and the staff responses at the bottom.
Okay, let's see. We have a motion before us to pay the claim. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, one other question. I'm just looking at the outgoing property sheet, and it says the option to mail it first class or mail it fourth class. I don't see where you have the option to send it registered mail, or is there such an option available to inmates? And it does, yes, I think mail charge says $5.35 plus $1.50. That would seem to indicate there were two charges made with respect to mail. I guess what I'm wondering is that if I'm an inmate and I want to return my shoes and I want to take due diligence and make sure that they get there, but I don't have the option to do that, and that would affect my, you know, who's got liability here, I think. But are there other options besides first and fourth class mail for someone to send out? Could they send it out a registered mail, or, you know, some kind of tracking to make sure that it got where it was supposed to go? In this sheet, it doesn't appear that that's an option.
As opposed to post office.
Mr. Chair, while they're pondering that, I can just say I don't know what happens at the institution when you mail things, but having mailed some holiday gifts, I was always asked if I wanted to pay the extra fee to have a tracking ability. So there's an additional charge, and you fill out a separate form. And I just don't know if those forms are available at the institution or if you have a mobile post office that comes in, or I don't know how that's set up, but it is an extra charge and an extra form you fill out.
I suspect, Representative Loeffler, that it's a matter of when you send out a parcel, if you send it out by first class, the postage is substantially higher than if you send it out what we used to call, back when I was young, parcel post, which I think is fourth class mail.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I actually sent something parcel post and was still asked if I wanted to pay for the tracking. So I know the post office has gotten, you know, very entrepreneurial, and there's lots of options and lots of extra charges.
Right. It appears as though the two charges were, one was for $5.35 postage, the other was $1.50 for shipping and handling charges.
Yep, I see that, yes. I guess, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hart, my question is, would the inmate have the opportunity, if they wished, to have their package tracked, or is that not an option for them to choose?
Ms. Lynn?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, I guess I'm not quite sure what first-class mail means, if that means that you pay the extra and get a tracking number on it, or what fourth class says, you just drop it in the mailbox.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not an expert in shipping things, so don't. But it seems to me that you can pay an extra fee and you can request that the post office, you know, get a signed receipt to send back to you to acknowledge that the thing that you sent was actually delivered, and you can do some things if you're concerned that they actually get where you want them to go and be able to validate that happened. And My question is that if you can do that at a post office, but you can't do it here, then if the person wanted to do that but couldn't, then I think there would be some liability on the part of the department to bear responsibility for their loss. If they had the option to have that done and chose not to, then I think they assume that liability themselves. And that's all I'm trying to understand, is whether they had the opportunity.
Right. I'm assuming, Senator Hahn, though, if this particular offender had chosen to send it out fourth class, that I don't know she would have necessarily, even if first class were available, that she would have necessarily taken that option anyway.
Well, and Mr. Hartnett, Mr. Chairman, again, I'm not an expert. I don't know that first class in and of itself causes there to be any tracking. It may be more costly. It may cause the mail to be delivered sooner. And so if the person says, well, I can pay $10 and have it go first class and it gets there tomorrow, or $5 and go fourth class and gets there in 3 days, it's only a matter of time. And since I got plenty of time, I don't care. But it seems to me that first class doesn't in and of itself mean that there's any tracking that's done. But if I have the opportunity to ask for that and pay additional for it, then I might do that if I was concerned about it actually getting there. But if I don't have that opportunity, then I don't. Then I just have to take my chances, I guess. And that's what I'm trying to understand.
I don't know one way or the other whether she was offered the opportunity to ask for a return receipt. All we have in here is a document that says she checked that it go out fourth class.
Right. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess maybe I'd like to have some clarification on whether that's possible for a person who wanted to take that responsibility to make sure that those things could be done. If it's not possible, then I think that would certainly affect my evaluation of the liability issue.
Other questions?
Do you want to table that then, or
we'll see?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you have exhibit number 8 from Terry Hamanek. They had it 8-2108. And it says that I have reviewed your file, and it shows that these shoes were mailed out from the facility to JCPenney on 6-1708. You did not request that these be mailed out with any special mail services, so there would not be a receipt from either the post office or vendor.
Mr. Chairman, and that would seem to imply that there is some process or some option to do something other than just mail it out, but I guess that's not clear from the document that those options are available, and maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's, if there was that opportunity and she chose not to avail herself of it, then I think she has to assume the responsibility.
Further questions? Hey, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion fails. A motion to deny. Or Lats moves to deny the claim. Any further questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Senator Hand, I didn't hear.
I voted in favor of the motion to deny.
Motion prevails. Claim is denied.
The final property to be discussed today is Chester Grauberger, and this is another television damage claim. And in this case, Mr. Grauberger claims that the power had been shut off by the facility due to a breaker in the kitchen that had to be replaced. So the power was shut off and then turned back on to make sure the breaker was working. And the claimant claims that his television, which was about a 10-year-old 19-inch RCA color TV, was broken or failed to work after the power outage. He turned it back on and it didn't work. And it had been working previously. The department recommended denial, and actually Mr. Lindeke made a notation of no clear evidence that damage TV was caused by power outage and recommended denial. But then there was some additional information that the claimant submitted after he received Newton's denial, and that is on the last two pages, or last page, double-sided page of your documentation.
Is this a repeat claim? That we've denied it once already?
Mr. Chair, no, this is the first time that you're hearing it. I denied it, and then he appealed my denial.
It seems that the crux of his claim is that he was not given any notice of a planned power outage, and that if he had received that notice, he would have unplugged his TV and
provided a power outage.
That he would have unplugged his TV and avoided the damage. And, you know, and then the department's response was that they tried to give offenders notice about all planned power outages, but that isn't always possible.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hamm.
this document on the last page, also in his response to your denial, Ms. Lindy, he says that two other people, Andrew Krosh and Michael Staunton, who live in the same section, also say that their TVs were damaged in the same circumstance. And is there any record of that in your...
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamm, no. So they don't file a claim with those offenders.
So they did not make a claim. They did have damage. They didn't make a claim. Okay.
Well, it's been many years since I've been an electrician, but I don't know how you cause a TV to go... cause damage by turning off the breaker. I mean, it would...
Well, it's probably the surge of what goes back on.
Mr. Chair, didn't we have another one today on a same thing?
Turning it back on.
I'm confused.
Well, that's...
Same voltage before or after.
I was just curious. I see they mailed the TV. Is that a common practice?
To mail TVs?
As he says, he mailed the TV to Sterling Electric for repair, for waiting instruction. That's on the last.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I don't know that it's a common practice, but I know that offenders do have, if they wish, can send their televisions out to repair shops. Mail would be the typical. Now, when he says mail, I don't know whether it's something that was sent out via UPS or the United States Mail or whatever it happened to be.
Did you insure it?
I think really
he's
it.
Still sitting at the Sterling Electric.
Apparently got it.
Mr. Chair, I will make a move to deny this one, or a motion to deny this one.
Senator Olsen makes motion to deny Jester's claim. How do you pronounce that last name?
Graubert?
Close enough. Any further questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The claim is denied. Counsel?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think the last item on the agenda is the dollar amount for... the medical expenses resulting from injuries to the conditionally released offenders performing sentence to service and community service work. There's a grouping of payments made between January 1, 2008 and December 18, 2008 in the total amount of $3,765.58. There was a one-page document to that effect from Ms. Lind that was in your supplemental packet. And those claims were all under $500, but they totaled that $3,765.58.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and staff, just to clarify for me, why are these handled separately and they don't go into our bill? Is that correct? It's just a transfer of money from somewhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the statute says that the department is to handle claims which are $500 and less, and what we do is we pay those out of a kind of revolving budget, and at the end of the budget year, we ask for reimbursement for that amount. That reimbursement forms the kind of at least the backbone of that budget. And obviously, the claims kind of go up and down. What we have done is to, because the statute also says these matters are handled at the medical assistance amount, we apply the $500 after the medical assistance amount is, otherwise you folks would be hearing all of these claims, and there are dozens and dozens of them. Many claims are less than $100. Somebody steps on poison ivy, they go to the emergency room and get it checked, it's $75. We pay that at the medical assistance rate and then put it into the reimbursement amount.
Which we used to hear.
I'm sorry?
There was a time when we heard all the whole bunch of claims.
Well, that was before my time, Representative Osmond.
Don't remind me.
Mr. Chair, my question was whether this authorizes the funds to actually go into your account now or if this is going to be part of the claims bill in the next session. That's why I was just confused about this.
I believe it's in the claims bill.
Okay.
Representative Loeffler, by way of reminding that this body met, I believe, last March or April, and we had claims that couldn't go into the claims bill that were approved by the claims subcommittee that we would ask to have go into the claims bill. They're over $500 claims, but those were paid by the Department of out of our budget. There were, I think, four STS claims and then an equal number of inmate injury claims.
As long as we approve from that.
Mr. Lindicke, I'm sure, has got the details on that. So.
Okay. And the guy that lopped off his finger?
Oh. That claim is still pending, Senator Olsen.
Hey, do we have a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Senator Olsen makes a motion to approve the claims request for 2008. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, before you bang that gavel, I have two questions I'd like to ask. They're brief. One is, you know, when we toured the prison, it kind of jumps out. You know, we get all these different TV prices. You know, should there be a standard TV that's, you know, $149 or something? Because some of the prices we got, like $209 for reimbursement, they're all over the board. And the second question I have is, on these tennis shoes, I think it's just ridiculous that people have Nikes and Adidas and all of these shoes. I feel that there should be a standard shoe, that this is our shoe that we issue, and that's the prison shoe. But that's just my own. But I'd like to know what you guys think about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olsen, the issue about shoes has been an issue for as long as I've been on working for the department. And the difficulty is that most of our offenders are young, and my 18-year-old son has got a stack of shoes that go from one wall to the other in his room. Athletic shoes are an important fashion accessory for him. I believe that that's probably the case in the prisons as well with most of our younger offenders. We do have some standard shoes, and they also get issued work boots if they're, their job requires it, or if they need to go outside, they get warm boots, et cetera, et cetera. But as long as we don't have we do have a uniform now that we didn't have when I first started in this business, but the shoes are still an option for them. And I suspect that it has to do with just their being able to assert whatever individuality they want to have. And the shoes get traded, they get stolen. It's a problem, but we haven't made the leap to go from Allstate-issue shoes for whatever reason. With regard to, I'm sorry, your other question was?
The TVs being standardized, because we see these prices all over the board.
Televisions are purchased through what's called the Access Catalog. Access is a company that is a wholesaler of property for correctional facilities. They're the ones who, I don't know, they're probably made in China, the same as everybody else's TV, but the transparent TVs come from Access. When we made our policy change that all new TVs had to come from Access, that's when all those transparent TVs started coming out. We didn't say, but you got to throw away your non-transparent TV, so it's been kind of a process of grandfathering. I don't know whether or not there are different grades of televisions that Access carries, but the offenders, if they have the funds, can order whatever the wholesaler has available. And I suspect there probably is a range, which would be the reason why you see different prices. There is as with anything that's on our allowable property list, there is a maximum that will be reimbursed. We've talked about watches back when the offenders would bring in their own watches and they'd want to have reimbursement for $200 or $400. And the reimbursement was only $25. We've since said the only watches you can have are canteen watches, which tell time but don't end up being a commodity that can be traded in the black market in the prisons.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Lynn, hand.
Thank you. And just another question kind of along the same line of Senator Olstein. Is this catalog of goods, is that something if I went out on the Internet I could find and see what it is? Or is, I mean, I'm just curious to see.
I've never tried it. I've seen some pretty amazing things on the Internet, so I'm assuming that that's probably possible too.
But I guess my question is, are all the things that are available to this wholesaler available to inmates in the prison system? Is that just the policy of the prison to say you can have property that's in this catalog? And
Senator Hahn, they can have property that's on the allowable property list, and when they order, they can order from any number of vendors. There are certain items they have to order from the access catalog. For example, we would have lots of TV claims that occurred because the staff opened up the TV to find contraband. Okay, that's the reason we went to the transparent TV. So when someone buys a TV, they have to buy a transparent TV to eliminate that problem. There are some other electronic devices that have transparent cases on them, but for example, offenders, as you know, can order books from a number of different vendors. They can order clothing from different vendors. There are approved vendors and non-approved vendors. That has more to do with security than anything else because of our experience of having offenders order something from a purportedly small vendor where they would have a relative working, and that'd be a way to introduce contraband into the facility.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would first like to hear a report if we were able to do anything more with the gentleman who lost his special. I'm now forgetting the name.
Sandman.
The Sandman, yes, and his special medicine bag. That's what it's called, a medicine bag. And I also want to say thank you very much for being our chair for the past 2 years. It's been good to be with you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that. I wish I had more of the report to give you with regard to Mr. Sandman, other than he has been compensated. When we tried to make some arrangements, he was really much preferred just handling things right in the office, and Mr. Lindeke handled that directly with him and took care of it appropriately. And I think all parties are as pleased as they can be or will be.
Mr. Lindeke went so far as to find the actual treasurer of state, and the check was cashed on the very day of delivery at the treasurer's office that still exists. So, and there was a closing ceremony that was held up in the revisor's office. We happen to have an attorney who is Native American, and she came in and helped with the closing ceremony, and so I think it was handled. Mr. Lindeke and Ms. Glasserny of my office handled it well, I think.
And I really appreciate it. I was out of state at the time, and there was an urgency expressed and needed to be taken care of, period. So that's what happened. And we have one small item of business, for a note. There were a couple of claims that were on earlier agendas that were postponed. So if somebody happens to note that, it's officially on the record that they'll be coming up in the future. But they were postponed at the request of the claimants.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Lentz.
I want to add to Representative Loeffler's comments. As your co-chair for the last 2 years, it's been a real pleasure and honor to serve with you. I've learned a lot from serving in and from our personal interactions through a lot of difficult hearings as well as more routine hearings. I appreciate the opportunity to serve with you.
Well, it's mutual. Thank you very much. It's been a great opportunity for me. I really appreciate sharing this. I really appreciate the speaker letting me, asking me to be on this. It was really an honor. I'll never forget that. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yes. I'd like to follow up on that because, you know, from going to $84 Nikes to a bridge collapse, I mean, the privilege of being on this committee during that has been inspiring for me, and just being a part of all that. And your leadership has been very good leadership through that time. So, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to have my congratulations and appreciation expressed on record as well. And I think all of us have been profited by your guidance, and it's been a great opportunity for me, and I just thank you for your service and your leadership.
Thank you. Your words are much appreciated, and I want to express my gratitude for the terrific staff we've had and support from staff over the years. Mr. Lindicke especially has just been outstanding and just a wonderful individual, as well as just a real colleague to try and help resolve these items in the best interest of the citizens of Minnesota. So I appreciate that. Anything else? We are adjourned. Last time.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
You keep these folders then, too? The ones you
think.
No, I'm where did these come from, by the way?
Okay. Don't worry about that. Good luck to you.
Oh.
Yeah, very good.
Thank you very much. Shellphone showed up at the office.
Ah.
I was sitting at Otter's.
Thank you. I'm glad you got to tour the
yeah, that was awesome.
It was on the phone for about an hour.
I'm glad they let us out.
Yeah.
One of those tours we're going to
I was out of town.
Well, you know, it's a lot of psychological energy.
I just fell.
Our city.
Walking just the other way, you know.
Thank you for doing that.
Future's going to continue. There's challenges.
Is that really?
Yeah.